I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. First to Denver, where some high schoolers are using AI to make voting easier for those whose first language is not English.
I want to connect to more people to let them know that, like, their vote really matters and that it should be heard.
Later, to a Kansas City area church that's working to bring down the temperature of political rhetoric.
We're trying to blanket Kansas City in love, compassion, understanding, and just calm down.
And we'll look at the science behind the headlines with NPR's Shortwave podcast.
Those stories and more coming up after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The presidential campaigns are in the final make-or-break hours of closing arguments on the cusp of Election Day. According to the final NPR-PBS News Marist poll of this cycle, Vice President Kamala Harris holds a 4-point lead over former President Donald Trump among likely voters nationally. However, that's roughly the margin of error. So neither has a clear advantage in this election. Both Trump and Harris are making a fierce push for votes in Pennsylvania today, where its 19 electoral votes offer the biggest prize of the most crucial battlegrounds. NPR's Deepa Shivram reports Harris started by rallying with supporters at a canvass kickoff in Scranton.
Harris told the crowd they should enjoy it as they try to get out the vote and shared an anecdote about her first run for office in 2003 when she'd campaign outside grocery stores using an ironing board as a standing desk.
And I would require people to talk to me as they walked in and out of the grocery store. And I will tell you, that is how I love to campaign. I don't do it as much anymore, obviously.
Harris did not refer to former President Trump by name in her remarks, but called him, quote, the other guy, and said his political era has been about making people feel alone. Deepa Shivram, NPR News, Scranton.
Here's former President Trump a short time ago in Reading.
If we win Pennsylvania, not me, if we win Pennsylvania, we win the whole ball of wax. It's over.
Trump says, if elected, he's open to reconsidering fluoride in drinking water. That's a central issue for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who may be advising Trump on the federal health policy if he wins tomorrow's election. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports public health experts are alarmed by the comments.
Dr. Paul Offit is with the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
Fluoride's been well tested. It clearly and definitively decreases cavities.
Over the weekend, former President Donald Trump's rival-turned-ally Robert F. Kennedy Jr. declared that on Inauguration Day, Trump would advise all U.S. water systems to remove fluoride.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a science denialist. He makes up his own scientific truths and ignores the actual truth.
Kennedy is urging all his supporters to vote for Trump so he can be empowered to, quote, clean up corruption at the federal health agencies like the Food and Drug Administration and the National Institutes of Health. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
More severe weather's on the way from the southern plains into the Ozarks and the mid-Mississippi Valley. The National Weather Service projected thunderstorms linked to tornadoes, large hail, and damaging winds today. Parts of Oklahoma are recovering from twisters that injured at least 11 people over the weekend. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has closed down 257 points to end the day at 41,794. This is NPR News. Eight people charged with the beheading of a teacher in France are on trial today in Paris. The victim, Samuel Paty, was killed outside his school in 2020 after showing caricatures of Islam's prophet Muhammad during a class about freedom of expression. More than a month after Israel launched its ground offensive against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, the Lebanese Health Ministry reports the conflict has claimed more than 3,000 lives. In Israel, 72 people, including dozens of soldiers, have been killed in Hezbollah attacks. Scientists have long known that being exposed to light at night can be detrimental to our health. NPR's Will Stone reports on new research that shows how much light we get and when can have major consequences.
Nearly 90,000 people in the UK wore a light-sensing device for a week. Then researchers based in Australia analyzed their risk of dying over the next 8 years. They found bright nights were associated with an increased risk of mortality. The top 10% who had the brightest evenings had a 34% increased risk of dying compared to those with darker evenings. On the other hand, people with the brightest days had a substantially lower risk. Daniel Windrid, the study's lead author, says the best thing to do is get outside.
There's like a massive jump in the intensity between an indoor and an outdoor light environment.
In fact, research shows that brighter light during the day can make you less sensitive to disruptions in your circadian rhythms at night. Will Stone, NPR News.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Insperity, providing HR services and technology, from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters. And the Doris Duke Foundation.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Dole Institute of Politics, hosting attorneys Ed Duckers and Pedro Irigonegaray for their program, The Counselors, Thursday, November 14th, 6:30 p.m. More at doleinstitute.org.
63 degrees with light rain and a little bit of fog. This is KPR. It's 3:06.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. The 2024 presidential election is almost over, and the candidates are making the most of the remaining hours. Former President Donald Trump is bouncing between the battleground states of Michigan, North Carolina, and, of course, Pennsylvania.
But we have to turn out and vote tomorrow. We're going to vote.
Vice President Kamala Harris is spending the whole of her day in must-win Pennsylvania, stumping in Pittsburgh, Allentown, and Scranton.
Let's get out the vote!
Harris's day ends with a concert in the state's biggest city, Philadelphia, of course. NPR's White House correspondents Tamara Keith and Franco Ordonez have been covering all of it. And for the next few minutes, they're here with us to look back. Hi to both of you.
Hello.
Hey, Juana.
Franco, I want to start with you. There have been just a whole lot of ups and downs in this campaign. But if you remember, there was a point in this race where former President Trump, he looked almost unbeatable.
Yeah, for sure. And I'd say that moment was following the debate with President Biden and going into the Republican National Convention. I mean, it's really hard to imagine a debate going worse for Biden. It led to the end of his campaign. And then there was the assassination attempt that happened in Pennsylvania. It was a scary moment. But Trump got up, he lifted his fist, he yelled, fight, fight, fight. And that became the iconic moment and the rallying cry for the rest of his campaign. I mean, he went into that convention, the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, with just unbelievable momentum.
That's right. And then President Biden made the decision to drop out of the race. Tam, over to you. How did that change the momentum for Democrats?
It was a tectonic shift. Harris quickly locked down the nomination. And then early on in her candidacy, I remember being on Air Force Two when she landed at the Detroit airport for a rally. And looking out the window, it was clear that this was going to be huge. As we waited for Harris to exit the plane, her staff were on the tarmac, dancing, like literally dancing, okay. As a DJ entertained this crowd of 15,000 people. This was a pure joy moment for her campaign and her supporters, and a huge sigh of relief and just outright euphoria for Democrats who had been facing such grim prospects. This rally and others like it in the earliest days of Harris's candidacy had such a high level of enthusiasm. It was like something Democrats hadn't seen since Obama.
Yeah, if I can just jump in, I'll say that that same time period was also Trump's toughest period. I mean, really, for 5 or 6 weeks, the Trump campaign really struggled. I mean, he was just caught flat-footed and unable to counter. It was just a massive shift in the race. And Tam and I have been talking about how Trump was really stuck on focusing on Biden.
Yeah.
It kind of robbed him of, you know, the easy walk to the presidency that he thought he was going to have. I mean, he kept talking about a coup, and that kind of hurt him because he was unable to, or at least very slow, to adapt to his new opponent.
Okay, so that was Trump's biggest challenge. Tam, what would you say the toughest moment was for Vice President Harris?
For Harris, it was like the joy phase turned into the grind phase in October. She hit a skid when she went on The View for what should have been an easy interview, and she didn't have an answer to the question of what she would do differently from President Biden. She still doesn't have a great answer to that, and it has become a regular feature of campaign ads from Trump and his allies.
Vice President Harris has spent most of this campaign talking about herself as the underdog, describing herself as such. What is she saying on that now?
Well, the underdog phrasing is gone. It dropped out of her speech a few days ago. Then over the weekend, her campaign announced it was ending on a positive note, and she stopped directly referring to Trump in her remarks. I don't know if this is real confidence or projecting confidence, but she is saying she will win.
And we have the momentum because our campaign is tapping into the ambitions, the aspirations, and the dreams of the American people.
Franco, tell us, what has the mood been like within the Trump campaign in these closing days of the race?
Well, I mean, I'll say the Trump campaign is also projecting a lot of confidence. I mean, they point me to polls that show him doing better than he did in 2016 and 2020 at this point. I mean, Trump was behind in those races at this time. I mean, but the candidate, former President Donald Trump, it is a different story. I mean, he's really unleashing some of his darkest rhetoric of the campaign. I mean, he really just keeps going off script and just unloading on all these grievances.
To get me, somebody would have to shoot through the fake news, and I don't mind that so much.
I mean, having heard Trump for most of the last decade, we know how he lashes out, and he does that often when he feels vulnerable.
The three of us have covered a lot of campaigns between us, many of those together. Tam, I want to start with you with all of the campaigns you've covered over the years. What's going to stick with you from this one?
Yeah, on Friday, I was in the pool traveling with Vice President Harris in Wisconsin. And that night, she had a huge rally in Milwaukee. But what sticks out to me is the rally earlier in the day in Little Chute, population 12,000. This was a county that Trump won by 10 points 4 years ago. And on the drive in, there was this large crowd of Trump supporters waving flags and banners. But then as we got closer, there was a big line of Harris voters who couldn't get into the rally because the high school gymnasium was already overfilled. That enthusiasm was very real. The Harris campaign has talked a lot about working to win by less in red and purple counties. That's what this was all about. We won't know until the results come in whether that moment speaks to a larger trend or not.
Franco, what about you? What will you remember most?
I mean, I'd say win or lose, I think it's just a shocking political comeback that Trump's made. After stoking the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, the multiple indictments, all the scandals, and then to be today knocking on the door to be the first convicted felon to win the White House.
NPR's Franco Ordonez and Tamara Keith, thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
In the Amazon rainforest, it's been the driest year in more than a century. Throughout South America, countries are grappling with less water, battling record wildfires, and rationing energy as hydropower generation plummets. Millions of people who depend on the rivers and tributaries have seen their livelihoods sink along with the water levels. NPR's Kerry Kahn brings us this report from Manaus, the largest city in Brazil's Amazon.
From his small stall at Manaus' raucous indoor fish market, Dantas Abreu has a unique perspective on how this huge port city has changed in just one generation. He has two kids. One is 26, the other 2.5. The big gap, definitely a surprise, he says. Being a dad at 50, it's way different. 25 years ago, there weren't cell phones or computers, but today my 2-year-old cries if I don't give her my smartphone, he says. Also, 2 decades ago, there was lots of fish in the rivers, he says, and money flowed easily, too. But these last 2 years have been devastating, nothing he's ever seen before.
Baixada do Rio sumiu, peixe. Aumentou tudo, tá entendendo?
The river dropped, and so did the amount of fish. Everything costs more now, he says.
Muito difícil, muito difícil. A nossa situação aqui no Amazonas está muito difícil.
It's so difficult here in Amazonas, Brazil's largest state by area in the rainforest, he says. Just as a customer starts haggling over the cost of a kilo of his pirarucu filets.
Deixa, que eu ainda vou comprar verdura, quem sabe eu volto.
He won't budge, and she retreats, saying she'll just stock up on more vegetables. Abrio says he's lost half his clientele. Never has there been so little recorded rainfall in the Amazon, the world's largest river system and the Earth's most important carbon-absorbing region. Scientists point to the rise in global temperatures as well as a stronger-than-normal El Niño weather pattern for the devastating dryness now stretching into a second year. Joao Arroldo Vieira takes a small boat out of one of Manaus' busiest ports. He stops mid-river and cuts the engine. Here the black waters of the Rio Negro and the murky Amazon meet, but don't mix, in a spectacular contrast. Vieira also points out the river's dry, exposed banks.
Essa praia aqui era pequena aqui, aí aumentou para cá.
We're right in front of a huge sandbar that has appeared in recent years, and with every drought, he says, it gets higher and higher and bigger, and it extends further into the river.
Triste porque está diminuindo o rio, né? A água está sumindo, está crescendo as terras. Ficando com pouco rio para a gente andar.
It's sad to see the river like this, he says. It's getting smaller, and the land keeps growing. There's not enough river left for us to move about, he adds. Whole communities have been left stranded. Residents are dependent on the Amazon's mighty rivers and tributaries to move everything in this state with few roads. And lower river levels mean fewer ferries can cross, and with lighter loads. The government has rushed out more transportation boats and has begun dredging the Amazon in hopes of widening passageways. November usually begins the rainy season, but most, like Manaus fishmonger Dantes Abreu, are anxious. Meteorologists are skeptical that the upcoming rains will be enough to make up for this long two-year drought.
O homem, né? O homem tá acabando a natureza. E a natureza tá dando a sua resposta, né?
Man has destroyed nature, he says, and nature is now just answering back. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Manaus, Brazil.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 91.3 FM in Junction City. We are always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Lawrence Public Library, offering the New York Times and Washington Post online, Ancestry.com, and more, all available with a library card. Card information at lplks.org.
Thanks so much for making KPR part of your day. In our next 30 minutes news headlines, we will learn how U.S. officials and disinformation experts have been calling out Russia for circulating fake videos to influence American voters.
This is something certain communities want to believe, and so when they're told it, they're more likely to repost it.
More on Russia's latest efforts to meddle in the U.S. elections. And speaking of U.S. elections, more than 2,000 immigrants become citizens in Kansas each year, and many of them are excited to be voting in their first election.
Some of us didn't really come from a place where you have the liberty to do what is right. You know, so I feel very happy to be here.
How some first-time voters could make a difference in this election. It's all coming up here on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Z's Divine Espresso, offering organic coffees via drive-thru windows and inside at 1800 East 23rd Street and 2351 West 31st in Lawrence. CoffeeInLawrence.com.
60% chance of rain tonight. We do still have a chance of thunderstorms. Lows in the upper 40s. We're expecting temperatures to be falling throughout the afternoon. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy in the morning, becoming mostly sunny. Highs in the upper 50s for this election day. 64 degrees currently in Topeka, 64 in Emporia, 63 here in Lawrence. It is 3:20.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from National Geographic Documentary Films, presenting Endurance. Endurance follows a team of modern-day explorers who face the Herculean task of finding Sir Ernest Shackleton's famous sunken ship, now streaming on Hulu and Disney+. And for designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Instead of thinking about Election Day tomorrow, you could imagine the election in three phases. There's been early voting. About 80 million people have cast their ballots so far. Then comes the blitz of votes tomorrow. And finally, the counting, which could take days. NPR's Miles Parks is here to walk us through what election officials and security experts are looking for in all three of those phases. Hey, Miles.
Hey, Ari.
Okay, first, early voting. My understanding is that numbers are lower than during the pandemic of 2020, but still very high historically. What else can you tell us about those numbers?
Right. So this is the highest non-pandemic early vote total ever. Mm-hmm. And most of it is coming from early in-person voting, with Republicans specifically coming around to this voting method after the Republican candidate, Donald Trump, kind of gave Republican voters the green light to start voting this way. The open question here is whether it matters, because this could be a lot of people who voted on Election Day in 2020 who just moved those votes a couple days earlier. Experts generally, though, are really happy with how voting is going at this point. One detail that caught my eye this week is there was all this concern about how Hurricane Helene a few weeks ago would impact the election, but counties affected by the hurricane are actually outpacing the rest of the state when it comes to turnout.
Wow, that's really good news. So when we look ahead to tomorrow, how many people are expected to turn out and what are officials watching for?
So even though so many people have voted early, roughly half the country is still expected to vote tomorrow. That could be upwards of 70 million people. And any time that many people are doing the same thing on the same day, there will be problems, yeah. Right? Poll workers get sick. Someone's going to forget the keys to a precinct. I was at a briefing last week, and one election official said, a person will drive into a power line outside of a polling place and lose electricity. Somewhere in the country, right? So the question is more, are there trends? One thing I'll be watching for tomorrow is specifically the experience of Spanish-speaking voters. Mm-hmm. We have seen former President Trump pushing the lie that non-citizens are going to be voting in big numbers this election. And so voting rights groups are really monitoring to see whether those fears turn into voter intimidation at the polls.
Huh. All right. Well, once voting ends, counting begins, and experts have warned that that is a real period of uncertainty where misinformation can thrive. What's their message right now?
Please give us patience. It takes a lot of time to count hundreds of millions of pieces of paper. So if margins are tight, it may also take time for news outlets like the Associated Press to call a winner. And for that reason, when I talk to election officials, they say they're really hoping for the election not to be close. I talked with Neil Makija, who's the chair of the Board of Elections in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, and he said wide margins take a lot of pressure off election officials and also leave less room for interference in the process.
What I hope and what my message is in these final days is really to encourage every voter to make their voice heard so that we end up with an election that is decisive, that cannot be questioned.
Of course, his home state of Pennsylvania is the swing state with the most electoral votes. Are you expecting some of the more decisive states that could determine which way it goes to tally up their results quickly, or could it take a while?
It could definitely take a while. There's some optimism in some states. Michigan, for instance, has made processes a little easier for people for election officials to count. But in other places, specifically Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, the state legislatures in those places have not changed rules to make it easier for election officials to count mail ballots specifically. So that means results could take a while. Obviously, the polls in those states have also shown close to a dead heat. So election officials are gearing up for a very tense week.
As is the country. NPR's Miles Parks, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ari.
Voting in the U.S. can be complicated, especially for newly naturalized citizens whose first language isn't English. Some high school students in Denver, many from immigrant families, are trying to help, and they harnessed the power of artificial intelligence. Experts are praising their efforts, even if there is still concern about AI's accuracy. Colorado Public Radio's Jenny Brundine visited their classroom.
I want you to go to make a voting plan.
The students at DSST College View are 97% students of color, mostly Hispanic, some Vietnamese. In their civics class, after researching who votes and who doesn't, they wanted to do a project to help people less likely to vote. Many have parents who are naturalized citizens, but they're intimidated by the voting process. And senior Daisy Quintana says young people gravitate towards technology.
We were talking about how not many people vote and they have the ability to vote. So I feel like this encouraged us to make this app that could, like, help others want to vote and vote.
The English version of Colorado's Voter Guide is 122 pages this year. There is a Spanish version, but students say the technical language is confusing. It's out of reach, especially for young people and their family members. They wanted to build a simple way to engage disenfranchised voters in multiple languages.
This is where it tells you you can start your journey right here.
Juan Cruz Minero shows me the front page of their app called VoteWise Colorado. Students were divided into work groups like quality control or technical architecture. They built the app and a companion chatbot with their teacher and an industry partner from Tin Man Kinetics. I start asking questions. Am I registered to vote? Juan types into the bot, and I am.
Well, it gives us the link to Go Vote Colorado.
That's the official Colorado government site. I ask about individual ballot measures.
Proposition 129 is about establishing veterinary professional associates.
The answers are clear and simple to understand. In the larger world, experts say going to one of the big chatbots for voter information is not a good idea. They can give you incorrect or biased information depending on how you phrase your question. Virginia Tech professor Casey Myers.
As we know with all things AI, there's a real due diligence on behalf of the users to fact check it and to verify what they're being told.
University of Colorado computer scientist Jim Martin is concerned about chatbots oversimplifying pros and cons listed in the state voter guide.
OpenAI decides that, well, this is a good paraphrase, to shorten it or to elaborate. And you don't know whether or not that's consistent with what the legislative intent was.
But Meyer says it looks like the students made their app and bot responsibly with good safeguards. Student Angel Garcia.
Bots like these, we've made them trained on what's inside the actual documents, and I feel like it's more of a secure way to understand what's happening.
They used a platform called PlayLab, a nonprofit that gives teachers access to large language AI models with guardrails built in. And they followed national safety principles for educators working with AI. That included significant prompting and training focused on getting voters objective information from official sources. Students say they know the risks of AI, but they also see it as a way to address a problem they saw in their communities. Hector Sanchez Ruiz.
I want to connect to more people to let them know that, like, their vote really matters and that it should be heard.
After all this work, the kids are looking forward to learning election results tomorrow, like everybody else. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundy.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers and discover their ideal profession before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu.
This is NPR News.
As Americans hold their breath awaiting the end of another contentious election, TV news executives say they are ready-ish.
We have really made a sincere effort to get out there around the country and to understand the electorate.
This story and analysis of all things election related tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us first thing tomorrow morning, 5 to 9 a.m. on your KPR stations. Jay Schaefer will be your local host for Morning Edition.
Support for KPR comes from Cromwell Solar, installing solar since 1982 and now offering whole backup battery systems, such as Tesla Powerwalls for Kansas and Missouri. More information at cromwellsolar.com.
Stick around. News headlines are coming up next. 60% chance of rain tonight. Another chance of storms. Lows in the upper 40s tonight. Mostly cloudy tomorrow morning. Mostly sunny by the afternoon. Highs tomorrow in the upper 50s. It's 3:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, our science news roundup from NPR's podcast, Shortwave.
Including the discovery of a tadpole fossil that is more than 160 million years old.
When I saw it under the binocular microscope, I said, this is the best tadpole ever.
Best tadpole ever after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. One of the final campaign stops former President Donald Trump made today was in the swing state of North Carolina. NPR's Stephen Fowler tells us the Trump campaign, he says where Trump was, he actually started nearly an hour late this morning and spoke to an area, or rather an arena, that wasn't full.
The former president went through his usual points, attacking Democrats and painting a dire picture of immigration and what he'd do to change things if elected, like a new demand that Mexico stop the flow of migrants across its border. Otherwise,
I'm going to immediately impose a 25% tariff on everything they send in to the United States of America.
Trump did not address the economic ramifications of a tariff like that. North Carolina is the only swing state Trump won in 2020 and hasn't supported a Democrat since 2008. But like the other places up for grabs, polls show an incredibly tight race. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Vice President Kamala Harris making a final sprint today through the battleground state of Pennsylvania, where she has five campaign stops. More than 79 million voters have cast their ballot so far. Pennsylvania has 19 electoral votes up for grabs tomorrow. That's the largest among the states expected to determine the Electoral College outcome. Harris urging supporters in Scranton to be intentional about building community and unity.
The way I've always been thinking about our campaign in these next 24 hours is, as we are getting out the vote, as we are canvassing, let's be intentional about building community. About building community, about building coalitions, about reminding people we all have so much more in common than what separates us. There is power in that. There is power in that.
Polls have the candidates virtually tied heading into Election Day. This is NPR News.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Hundreds of people in Kansas are waiting for life-saving organ transplants. Jan Finn is CEO of the Midwest Transplant Network, which is the main organ procurement agency for Kansas and parts of Missouri. She says approximately 2,500 people in Kansas and Missouri are waiting for new organs. One of her group's main challenges is fighting misconceptions about organ donation.
We try to address those right off the bat, that they can have an open casket, that organ donation should not interfere with any final plans that they have. Organ donation does not cost anything to the donor family.
Finn says they try to combat negative stereotypes about organ donation, and for the most part, Kansans are receptive. She says most people in their service area are noted as organ donors on their driver's licenses. Every harvest season means the movement of huge amounts of grain. And as Harvest Public Media's Jim Meadows reports, for those dealing with grain on farms and at elevators, it can be dangerous.
Walking on a pile of grain can be like walking on quicksand, and farm workers have suffocated after sinking into grain inside bins. Stuart Beckman is safety director for Columbia Grain in North Dakota. He says workers who detect an issue inside a bin sometimes ignore the risks.
And then people feel compelled to enter a bin to try and get that grain to move or walk that grain down, and those are very dangerous things, and we do not allow that.
OSHA's Kansas City Regional Office recently added Missouri to the list of states where it's been emphasizing grain handling safety, along with the states of Kansas and Nebraska. I'm Jim Meadows, Harvest Public Media.
The conclusion of last week's World Series signaled a start to baseball's off-season, and the Kansas City Royals are already making waves. Greg Eklund reports.
The Royals have retained starting pitcher Michael Wacha, who finished with a 13-9 record this season. Wacha could have opted out of his contract and become a free agent, but instead the Royals agreed to a new deal that extends to 2027. Royals general manager J.J. Piccolo says he had some optimism based on Waka's family and the team's pitching coach.
Michael and his wife, they enjoy being in Kansas City. That's always an advantage. He had a very good experience here. I think he and Brian Sweeney got along great.
Sweeney, who completed his second season as the team's pitching coach, will also be back next season. I'm Greg Eklund.
The forecast for northeast and east central Kansas, 60% chance of rain tonight, a chance of thunderstorms, lows in the upper 40s, mostly cloudy tomorrow morning, becoming mostly sunny with highs in the upper 50s, lows in the upper 30s tomorrow night. Sunshine again on Wednesday, clouds moving back in on Thursday. We start seeing another good chance of rain on Thursday night. This is KPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. All year we've been talking about foreign countries trying to swing the U.S. election. And in these final days of voting, American officials have called out Russia for circulating several fake videos targeting U.S. voters. NPR's Shannon Bond is following this. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Ari.
What do these fake videos show?
Yeah, so we've seen just in the past 2 weeks, at least three of them spread on social media that these officials and researchers have flagged as fakes. And look, these are pretty clumsy videos. There's some obvious signs they aren't real, but that didn't stop many people from sharing them. So most recently, there was a video posted to X on Thursday of a man who said he was a Haitian immigrant who was voting multiple times in Georgia. Just days before, there was a different video claiming to show someone ripping up ballots marked for former President Trump in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, another swing state. And there was also another fake video making baseless claims against Tim Walz, the Democratic vice presidential nominee. And look, Ari, these Georgia and Pennsylvania videos, they were quickly debunked by state and local officials. And then we've had federal intelligence officials and the FBI come out and say all three videos were likely made by Russia. They say it's part of what they describe as the Kremlin's efforts to sow division among Americans and undermine confidence, ultimately, in this election.
And how similar or different is this from what we saw Russia attempt in the 2016 and 2020 elections?
Yeah, experts say that Russia is much more active this year, right? So they're just doing more. And in some ways, these efforts are more sophisticated. So if you remember back to 2016, the Internet Research Agency, that infamous Russian troll farm, right? They made fake accounts on social media posing as Americans, right? And they pushed out these fake stories about Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. Now, researchers believe these fake videos that we've been talking about are actually being produced by a group that's a successor to the Internet Research Agency. They stage these fake videos, but then they're laundering them in many cases through influencers. And then we're seeing them get picked up and shared by actual Americans. So, you know, these are not being spread by fake accounts. I spoke with Darren Linvell, who leads a team at Clemson University, which first identified this operation.
They've put effort into building the network. They put effort into, you know, making these connections with real humans. But it is also true that people are now primed for, I mean, you can't separate these things. The Russians changed their tactics to conform to the changes in our reality.
And what Linville is talking about here is this idea, you know, many Americans have become much more receptive to these claims that, you know, something fishy is going on. There's something wrong with elections, which have come after so many years of Donald Trump's attacks on election integrity. And now we see Russia really capitalizing on that.
Is it only Russia, or have other countries also been trying to influence this election?
Right. Well, Russia is the most prolific, but intelligence officials have also called out Iran and China as really active threats trying to reach American voters. And what's common among all three of these countries, which have different aims, but what's common among their tactics this year is this focus on divisive issues, you know, that are trying to exacerbate existing fractures in American society. You know, they're targeting specific groups of people. They're seizing on narratives, for example, about immigration, like we saw in that video from Russia, about abortion, the war in Gaza, and now, as voting comes to an end, the integrity of American elections. And look, this is just not going to end when polls close tomorrow. As we expect, it takes time to determine a winner. Intelligence officials are warning that these adversaries will likely keep doing this through the post-election period.
That is NPR's Shannon Bond, who will keep following this throughout the post-election period. Shannon, thank you for your reporting.
Thanks, Ari.
Sorry. In this heated election season, places of worship across the United States find themselves caught in the middle of intense partisan divides. As Zane Irwin of the Kansas News Service reports, one church in the Kansas City area has sparked a national effort to lower the temperature on the political conversation.
4 years ago, Pastor Adam Hamilton worried that his 24,000-member church in Kansas City was splitting at the political seams.
Our community has gotten, and our society has gotten more and more polarized.
After decades of refereeing debates at the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection about abortion, LGBTQ inclusion, and racism, it all got to be too much.
There have been two periods of time where I felt most like quitting. I told my wife this once in one of those periods, and I said, you know, are you okay if I take another job? And one time she asked me this question, is God gay?
Despite the political tension, the graffiti attacks, and the angry emails, Hamilton stayed. But he knew Resurrection would have to get creative if they wanted to counteract the social media algorithms and politicians.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Laura Lorson. Kansas isn't normally a battleground state nationally, but several key races are on the ballot this year, including the makeup of the entire state legislature. Experts say first-time voters could play a decisive role there, and that includes the thousands of Kansans who become new citizens each year. Rose Conlon filed this story.
Kansas who are now citizens and eligible to vote, according to a Pew Research Center analysis, comprising 4% of the state's electorate. They tend to be older than U.S.-born voters, and they're more likely to have a college degree. Jens Monwell Krogstad is a senior editor at Pew.
In close races, there are enough immigrant-eligible voters in Kansas where they could play a key role in deciding an outcome.
Every last vote will be important in determining the makeup of the Kansas legislature, where a few hundred votes sometimes separates winners and losers. A handful of races are expected to decide whether Republicans hold on to their legislative supermajority. Ifanye Obiajalu is an ICU nurse who moved to Kansas from Nigeria 6 years ago. He lives in Salina, but he's been in Wichita working at Ascension Via Christi St. Francis since the spring. Now that he's a citizen, he hopes it'll be easier for his wife to join him in Kansas. He's also excited to participate in the democratic process.
Trying to contribute and also being involved in politics. So becoming a citizen avails me that opportunity to, you know, run for an office, you know, get involved in what is going on in the country, perhaps in my local community and county.
An opportunity, he says, he didn't have in the same way in Nigeria.
Some of us didn't really come from a place where you have the liberty to do what is right. You know, so I feel very happy to be here.
Sandrine Lisk is a Wichita immigration attorney who's helped people become citizens for nearly 30 years. She says most of her clients have lived in the U.S. for a decade or longer, and they have complex reasons for pursuing citizenship. But she says politics is an increasing factor.
This year, particularly, most people have wanted to naturalize so that they can vote.
She says some of her clients are worried about what they see as rising anti-immigrant rhetoric in the U.S. Others are scared of experiencing voter intimidation at the polls, which Lisk says is rare, but occasionally happens.
I spoke to someone who is from a different part of the world and had a very strong accent and had to prove over and over and over again that he was a naturalized citizen entitled to vote.
Voter intimidation is illegal, and anyone who experiences it should tell poll workers. Obiajalu says he's excited about voting this election, but he's most looking forward to settling down in Kansas for good.
Back home in Nigeria, I lived in a very busy and big city. So when I came at first, Kansas seemed a little bit laid back. But after living here for a while, I developed more love for Kansas. So since then, I'm stuck. And I like being stuck in Kansas.
For the Kansas News Service, I'm Rose Conlin in Wichita.
If you encounter voter intimidation, you can call the Justice Department's District Election Officer for Kansas. That number is 785-295-2850. Again, that's 785-295-2850. The Kansas News Service reports on health, economics, education, and many other issues connected to public policy. To hear more stories like this one, visit the KPR website, kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Eagles Rest, a locally owned natural mattress and furniture store in Lawrence with heirloom quality furniture by Acornis, Copeland, Sisco Brothers, and Younger. Online at EaglesRestNaturalHome.com.
This is your place for NPR News from the University of Kansas, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence, lots of other frequencies too, and always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center at JCCC, presenting What If Puppets in Shiver Me Paintbrush, A Pirate's Adventure in Art, December 6th and 7th, created with a neurodivergent audience in mind. More at jccc.edu/mtc.
Lots more All Things Considered still to come. We're with you till 7 o'clock tonight, and we will have an update of news headlines at 4:01. It's 10 minutes before 4.
NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. All right, it's time now for our science news roundup from Shortwave, NPR's science podcast. I'm joined by the show's dynamic duo, Regina Barber and Emily Kwong. Hey, ladies.
Hey, Elsa.
Hi, Elsa. So good to be here.
So good to be with you. All right, so you have brought us three science stories that caught your attention this week. What are they?
We have these two amazing students who developed new math for proving the Pythagorean theorem, how animals eating overripe fruit in the wild may have affected evolution, and the discovery of a fossil that sheds new light on the life cycle of frogs.
Frogs! All right, well, what I really want to do is relive eighth grade geometry class, so let us start with the students tackling the Pythagorean theorem. What is their story?
Okay, so in 2022, two high school students shocked the math world by solving the Pythagorean theorem using trigonometry. And for doing this, Kelsey Johnson and Nakia Jackson earned keys to the city of New Orleans.
Whoa.
And now they are published mathematicians. Kelsey and Nakia published their work, 5 Proofs and a Method for Finding at Least 5 More, in the journal American Mathematical Monthly. It's super prestigious, and seeing the paper online, Kelsey started jumping up and down.
It's really great to see it not just on my own laptop, because that's where it's been for a very long time.
Wait, how old are they now?
They're sophomores in college.
That's incredible. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, can we just back up a little bit, though? Because the Pythagorean theorem, in case anyone needs a refresher course, it's about the three sides of a triangle that has one right angle, right?
Yeah, so over 2,000 years ago, the Greek philosopher Pythagoras figured out the equation a squared plus b squared equals c squared. Right.
Yes.
To calculate the length of a right triangle.
I mean, I still chant it in my sleep. It was drilled deep into my soul 35 years
ago. Was that a math cheer? Amazing. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. That theorem has been proven again and again with geometry and algebra, but it was once thought impossible to do with trigonometry. Like, only two other mathematicians had done it before Kelsey and Nakia. And that's because trigonometry is, like, based on the Pythagorean theorem. Mm-hmm. So it's tricky to use trigonometry to prove it.
Ah, I mean, this is kind of circular reasoning, right?
Right, but Kelsey and Nakia proved it could be done. They actually developed 5 proofs in total.
Kelsey's little overachievers.
Yeah, Kelsey's particularly proud of the proof that involves this infinite series of little triangles, which looks like a waffle cone.
Ooh, yummy, yummy. Mm. So wait, what's next for these two math superstars?
They're in college. Kelsey is studying environmental engineering at Louisiana State University, while Nakia is studying pharmacy at Xavier University. And Nakia had some advice for today's high schoolers. Finish what you start.
I know there's moments where you're like, I don't want to do this for real. But in the long run, it might be something that could have mattered if you had just tried or kept with it.
And that's certainly true for her and Kelsey, who both wanted to thank their parents for all their support.
Aw, what good kids.
I know, good kids.
All right. So let's move on. We're going to talk about overripe fruit. Animals eat this. I mean, I do.
I mean, I do, too. Elsa, have you heard of something called the drunken monkey hypothesis?
No, but this makes me want to hang out with some drunk monkeys.
Same. LOL. Okay. The drunken monkey hypothesis suggests that our human interest in alcohol may be due to the abundance of alcohol, especially ethanol, from all that rotting, naturally fermenting fruit in the wild.
No way!
Which animals have eaten throughout history.
Huh.
Yeah, but there was no consensus for this hypothesis among scientists who studied primates when the theory was proposed decades ago.
There was like 90% of primatologists who thought fermented fruit was very rare, and then there's 10%, a handful of primatologists who thought it was so common to be uninteresting. And that was kind of like the divide.
That's Matthew Kerrigan, who's an author of a review paper, which is an article that looks at a lot of studies that came out in the journal Trends in Ecology and Evolution.
Okay, so did they figure out how common it is for animals to eat fermented fruit?
So this review paper claims that many animals consume large amounts of fruit to survive, and they are bound to encounter fermented fruit with low levels of ethanol. So consuming this specific kind of alcohol is most likely very common. Also, if you eat a lot of these fruits, that alcohol is gonna make you tipsy. Yeah, and intoxication is dangerous out in the wild. Like, animals would be too vulnerable to predators or falling out of a tree. So Matthew says that our primate ancestors likely had to adapt to alcohol consumption and more or less become functional drinkers. They probably didn't have a choice.
And so it kind of flips the story in the head. Rather than being, you know, humans consuming alcohol to get drunk, to now perhaps it's the other way around, that animals are either intentionally or can't avoid consuming ethanol that they're going to be exposed to on a perhaps very routine basis.
Okay, so I have these monkeys to thank for how we evolved to be able to drink and break down alcohol, because our ancestors apparently could not avoid it.
Yeah. Matthew says we still don't know for sure if, like, animals actually prefer fermented fruit, like, sometimes seek it out. There needs to be more studies on that. But scientists are seeing more and more evidence that this was an evolutionary advantage to have enzymes break down alcohol, which may have led to many human civilizations enjoying it.
So interesting. Okay. Well, we have to move on now to another story about the animal world. I hear a new fossil of a frog has been found.
You heard that right. Though it is technically the fossil of a tadpole, the oldest known fossil of a tadpole. Tadpole, that's the larval stage of a frog's life, you know, when they're just little swimming polywogs with a tail.
Right, like, because frogs are like butterflies or salamanders in that they go through metamorphosis from their larval to their adult stage, yeah?
Yeah, we call this the biphasic life cycle. Mm. Back to this, like, really cool fossil. This tadpole fossil is 161 million years old from the middle to late Jurassic period, and it's incredibly intact, like, which is shocking because tadpoles are really delicate. They're made mostly of cartilage. And also, the tadpole stage only lasts a few months before the tadpole transforms into that adult frog. So it's been very hard for scientists to find tadpole fossils that are this well-preserved. Mariana Chulivert is the lead author of a new paper about this in the journal Nature. She said when she saw the fossil, she knew immediately what it was.
I said, okay, it's a tadpole. There is no doubt. But then when I saw it under the binocular microscope, I said, okay, this is the best tadpole ever. Because up to now, there wasn't any other fossil tadpole with the gill skeleton preserved.
The best tadpole ever with a preserved gill skeleton.
Yeah.
Okay. Does this amazingly preserved specimen teach us anything about, you know, frogs or how they evolve?
Yes, they think so. I mean, one of the interesting things about this specimen is its size. It's almost two times as big as the tadpoles we see today.
Wow.
And it is the oldest tadpole ever found by 20 million years. Yeah, this discovery proves that the tadpole phase goes way further back in evolutionary time than we knew. So, like, any kid who stared into a puddle knows how awesome tadpoles are. It turns out they're even more awesome than we thought if you ask evolution.
Wow, I have an even more robust love for tadpoles now.
Definitely. We share the earth with so many other species but us, so I'm comforted by this.
That is Emily Kwong and Regina Barber from NPR's science podcast, Shortwave, which you can subscribe to for new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and the science behind the headlines. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you, Elsa.
Thank you, Elsa.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Support for NPR comes from the station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations meet their food needs, from online ordering to simplified expense reporting, with a nationwide network of restaurants all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive, Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. From Insperity, providing HR services and technology, from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters. and from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
We're in the final stretch of this historic election season. I'm Scott Detrow. Join us for live special coverage of Election Night 2024 from NPR News.
It's tomorrow night, beginning at 6 o'clock our time, preempting the last hour of All Things Considered. You will hear that on your KPR1 stations. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org. Or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. News headlines coming your way in 60 seconds. It is 63 degrees in Lawrence. It is 4 o'clock.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a science denialist. He makes up his own scientific truths and ignores the actual truths.
Public health experts are alarmed at former President Trump's reliance on RFK Jr. as a health policy advisor.
For Monday, November 4th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, we'll get the results from NPR's final election poll.
And we're about to learn the impact of social media companies taking a more hands-off approach to election misinformation.
In some sense, they're greasing the skids for violence or greasing the skids for conspiracy theories.
Later, we'll hear reflections from the late Quincy Jones in his own words.
My teacher said, "Because you're going to learn everything everybody ever did with the 12 notes, from Stravinsky to Alvin Berg to Duke Ellington, everybody."
And an actual scientific study of how long it would take a monkey with a typewriter to bang out Hamlet.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. In ads and campaign speeches, Democrats have been trying to reach conservative women who may be reluctant to vote for former President Trump. As NPR's Sarah McCammon explained, several groups are trying to persuade suburban women to vote for Vice President Harris, even secretly.
Recent ads from anti-Trump groups are sending the message that women don't have to tell their husbands who they're voting for.
In the one place in America where women still have a right to choose, you can vote any way you want.
Jackie Payne with Galvanize Action, which focuses on moderate white women, says some keep their opinions quiet to avoid conflict.
So they're still very much voting, but they're, as they do so, they're navigating this conflict that they're experiencing with the folks around them.
The ads have sparked pushback from conservative commentators. Recent polls show a significant gender gap, with more women supporting Harris and more men supporting Trump. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
Harris is spending the final day before Election Day campaigning in Pennsylvania, which both candidates consider crucial to winning the presidential race. Former President Trump in Pennsylvania in Reading today, where the crowd responded with a resounding no when Trump asked attendees whether they were better off now than 4 years ago. Trump also noting that's how long he's been waiting to return to the White House.
Think of this, though. We're just one day away. Oh, we've been waiting for this. I've been waiting 4 years for this. And so have you. And so have you. We've all been waiting 4 years. One day.
Trump calling the 2024 election the most important political event in the history of our country. Republican presidential candidate will be in Pittsburgh today, as will his Democratic rival, Vice President Kamala Harris. With tomorrow's election, China is among the countries that will be watching results closely. However, the outcome of the vote seems unlikely to fundamentally change the course of a tense bilateral relationship. Here's NPR's John Ruich.
The Chinese government has tried to steer clear of openly commenting on the election or the two candidates. Both former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris are known quantities, though. Trump for the trade war he launched against China, and Harris as a key part of the Biden administration, which has kept the Trump-era tariff regime in place and expanded efforts to deny China access to key technologies. Many here in China are convinced that acrimony and friction between the U.S. and China will continue regardless of which candidate wins the election. Harris seems poised to keep running with Biden's competitive approach to relations with China, and Trump has threatened to dramatically increase tariffs on Chinese goods. John Ruich, NPR News, Guangzhou, China.
Stocks drifted lower on Wall Street ahead of the election. The Dow was down 257 points. You're listening to NPR. Striking machinists at airplane builder Boeing are voting today on whether to approve a new contract. The latest proposal would include a 38% pay increase over 4 years, as well as ratification and productivity bonuses. What apparently would not include, though, is a restoration of a traditional pension, which is something workers also wanted. Like many companies, Boeing froze its pension plan nearly a decade ago. Machinists have been on strike for 7 weeks now, virtually shutting down production of most of the company's passenger planes. Music legend Quincy Jones has died at his home in Bel Air, California. He was 91 years old. No cause of death was given by Jones' publicist. NPR's Walter Ray Watson says the iconic music producer's influence over popular music stretched over nearly seven decades.
Born in Chicago during the Great Depression, Quincy Jones seemed to have a superpower. As composer, arranger, a tastemaker of new artists and established ones, Jones surrounded himself with musicians who helped him precisely shape hit songs like this one, while bending the recording studio to his will. All things that made him creatively and quintessentially Quincy Jones. Walter Ray Watson, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices moved higher today after OPEC agreed to delay a proposed December output hike for another month. That will potentially keep supplies a bit tighter. Oil rose $1.98 a barrel to $71.47 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Learn more at templeton.org and the listeners who support this NPR station.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Bob Schwartz Financial, helping Kansans make informed financial decisions for their families for over 45 years. More at bobschwartzfinancial.com.
63 degrees in Lawrence, 59 in Manhattan. It is 4:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. With a little more than a day to go until voting ends, Vice President Harris is narrowly leading former President Trump among likely voters. That's according to an NPR PBS News Marist poll out today. But her lead is within the margin of error, and that means this race remains incredibly close. The new polling also gives us a better understanding of some trends we've been following this election cycle. Here to explain all of this and what it might mean as we head into Election Day is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Domenico, we've talked a whole bunch this election cycle. You've told us over and over again that this race is super close. So tell us what stands out to you in today's poll.
And still close. One thing that jumped out to me, though, were the responses to a question we asked about whether the candidates are mainly making proposals they intend to carry out if elected, or if they're putting them forward just to get people to vote for them. Now, 55% said that Trump intends to carry out his promises, whether they like them or not. But for Harris, likely voters were split 49-49. And I think this is really notable because it might tell us why she hasn't closed the deal with some voters. You know, it's been a hurdle for her to try and overcome her words and promises that she made during her presidential campaign 5 years ago when she was trying to court progressives. This has been a concern for her campaign because lots of voters continue to say they don't quite know her or what she stands for, despite what she's said very clearly in this campaign. And the Trump team has been happy to try and help them make up their minds with a relentlessly negative ad campaign over the past month against Harris.
Domenico, I find this super interesting. Anything notable in how different sorts of voters responded to that question?
Yeah, we saw a gender divide on who thought Harris was being sincere. A majority of women thought Harris intended to do what she was proposing, which has been more moderate than what she'd put forward in 2019. But a majority of men thought the opposite. And there was a huge divide by education. White women with college degrees overwhelmingly thought Harris would follow through on her promises. But huge majorities of white men who didn't go to college thought she's just saying these things to get votes.
There's been a lot of talk about the gender gap in the closing days of election season and the thinking that this could be the widest in history. Does this poll bear that out?
To an extent, it does. I mean, overall, there's a 15-point gender gap between men and women in their support for Harris or Trump. Harris leads with women by 11. Trump leads with men by 4. That's actually smaller than last month's divide. So who knows exactly what it's going to be on election day? But what's been clear is that college-educated women are key to Harris's election hopes.
Okay, let's set aside gender for a second. What other demographic groups are you watching this election season, and what does the poll tell us?
Well, Harris is doing quite well with black voters in this survey, and not far off from where she likely needs to be with Latino voters, too, and that could make a huge difference. 83% of black voters now say that they're with Harris. That's the highest since she's gotten into this race. So for all the talk about Trump siphoning off young black men, this is one good data point for Harris's team. Now, Harris is winning Latinos with 61%, and with Gen Z, she's at 56%. Those are a little short of where Democrats have been in the past when they've won, but remember, there's a wide margin of error here. It's bigger for subgroups in national polls. So it's not very far off from where Democrats have been when they've had success. Harris has to hope that the shift we're seeing with college-educated white voters in her direction, as well as baby boomers who say they're going to vote for her, could offset some of those potential losses. A light breeze in any of these directions, though, could change the outcome of who the next president of the United States is.
We will keep on watching. That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Former President Trump told NBC yesterday that removing fluoride from the water supply, quote, sounds okay to him. He was responding to a declaration from his ally Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's lined up to advise Trump on federal health policy, and Kennedy has spread misinformation about vaccines. As NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports, public health experts are alarmed.
Adding fluoride to water systems started in 1945 in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's been used widely since then to prevent tooth decay in children. In fact, the CDC has called it one of the 10 great public health achievements of the 20th century. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. explained his position on fluoride at an event with the New York Sun in September.
I think fluoride is a poison.
Over the weekend, he posted on X that on Inauguration Day, former President Donald Trump would advise all U.S. water systems to remove fluoride. He wrote, quote, fluoride is an industrial waste, unquote, and said it was associated with arthritis, IQ loss, thyroid disease, among other conditions. Not true, says Dr. Paul Offit of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
Fluoride's been well tested. It clearly and definitively decreases cavities and does not associate it with any clear evidence of the chronic diseases mentioned in that tweet.
Offit has written many books, including one about celebrities and politicians spreading debunked health information.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a science denialist. He makes up his own scientific truths and ignores the actual truths.
Kennedy is especially fervent in his advocacy against the use of vaccines, explains Offit.
Which diseases would he like to see come back? Polio, which, you know, caused up to 35,000 cases of paralysis a year and 1,500 deaths, or whooping cough, which would cause 8,000 children to die every year.
Kennedy on Monday posted a video urging his supporters to vote for Trump so he's elected with a strong mandate.
Then no one will be able to stop us when he empowers me to clean up corruption in the federal agencies, and especially our health agencies.
Those health agencies include the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, among others. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
There is one person who has worked with Michael Jackson and Frank Sinatra and Ray Charles. He wrote dozens of scores for film and TV and eventually produced movies and TV shows and got megastars together to sing We Are the World for charity. That would, of course, be Quincy Jones, who died last night at age 91.
Before he changed the course of popular music, he got his first big break in a jazz big band. Quincy Jones spoke with NPR's Michelle Norris in 2008. We pick up their conversation from when he was growing up in Chicago in what he called the heart of the ghetto.
Gangsters. Nothing but gangsters. Back in the 30s, it was all I ever saw with machine guns and stogies and big piles of money on the lights.
You saw all this?
That's all, as a kid, that's all I saw. I wanted to be a gangster till I was 11. Are you kidding?
In your book, you tell the story, you say that they pinned my hand to a wooden fence with a switchblade when
That's right.
I was 7 years old. Who was they?
they is being on the wrong block. If you went on the wrong street and didn't have the right call, you get a switchblade through your hand. I was 7 years old.
And they literally pinned your hand to a fence?
Yeah, and it was a switchblade. Now, also, ice pick in my temple. That's real fun.
They held it to your temple, or
they stuck it in my temple.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. I got the scar right, but my medal's to prove it here.
How did you get out of Chicago?
Capone ran the Jones boys out because they didn't know they were making so much money. And they ran into Mexico, and my dad came and got my brother and I at the barbershop the next day and took us on a trailway bus, no toys, and went straight to the Northwest. He worked in the Bremerton Navy Yard during the World War II, and then we went to Seattle 2 years later.
Now, that's where you met up with Ray Charles.
That's right, exactly. Exactly, you got your homework.
Well, I did my homework.
You sure did.
I knew who I was going to be talking to.
I met Ray Charles at 14. He was 16, but he was like 100 years older than me.
Quincy, my buddy. My buddy. Quite so true.
How'd you meet?
We met, it wasn't like the film. We met up at the Elks Club. The Elks Club is where we all went after all of the paying jobs, whatever they were, whenever they came. That's where we went to just play bebop for jam all night for free.
Musically speaking, you've bridged so many genres and generations also. I understand that Lionel Hampton was the person who gave you your big break. I want you to tell me not just about Lionel Hampton, but also about Gladys Hampton, because I understand
Gladys,
she stayed on top of you.
She was beautiful, absolutely beautiful. I was very upset, though, when I got thrown off the bus, because I really wanted to go on the road. That's all I cared about.
Thrown off
said,
the bus?
Honey, what's that child doing on here, Lionel? She said, honey, get off of this bus and go back to school. We'll talk later. And I sat on the bus for 4 hours, so they wouldn't change their mind, and boy, it didn't happen.
Tell me the story.
At 15 years old, he saw a piece of music I'd written called Sweet for the Four Winds. I didn't know what I was doing. He wanted to hire me as a trumpet player and arranger, and I just jumped on the bus. I didn't want to tell my parents or anybody. I didn't want anybody to change their mind, because it had been my dream to be a member of a big band. And Lionel Hampton at that time was bigger than Duke Ellington, a Basie, and Louis Armstrong. They all worked with Joe Glaser at Associated Booking, and he was the number one band. He worked 300 days a year, you know. And it was the most exciting, educational, learning experience I've had in my life.
So you went back to Berkeley to study music. It
yes.
wasn't called Berkeley at the time.
It was the Schillinger House of Music. That was a Russian mathematician. My teacher said, because you're going to learn everything everybody ever did with the 12 notes, from Stravinsky to Elvin Berg to Duke Ellington, everybody. I spent 28 years to hone my craft so I could write any kind of music. And I learned so much by working as a conductor and arranger for, you know, Billy Eckstein and Ray Charles and Peggy Lee, with no pressure on me. And in those days, we didn't care about money or fame. We couldn't care less.
Moonlight. The music super producer Quincy Jones in conversation with NPR's Michelle Norris in 2008. His publicist says he died Sunday night at his home, surrounded by family.
Woman needs man, and man must have his mate that no one can deny. It's still the same old story.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 89.7 FM in Emporia, and we're always online, streaming at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Iniquitoria, Andrew Sherwood, Ph.D., Jungian analyst. C.G. Jung suggested that dreams are intentional messages from the unconscious that, when interpreted correctly, provide balance and guidance in life. More at workingwithdreams.com.
Thank you so much for tuning into KPR today. Plenty more All Things Considered still to come. In our next half hour, we will have an update of news headlines. Then the presidential race appears extremely close. Film at 11. A contested election could mean legal challenges and potentially political violence.
The mere identification of the fact that you could have a problem demands a thorough plan to address it.
More on what such a plan might entail with Mary Louise Kelly. We will also learn more about the Senate race in Montana. Every single Senate seat is important in this election. Montana could swing it. We'll find out more coming up. Stick around.
Public radio listeners are engaged, curious, and community-minded. Your business can unleash the potential of our listeners by sponsoring Kansas Public Radio. Learn how at sponsorship.kansaspublicradio.org.
Quick reminder, you will hear NPR and KPR's coverage of Election Night 2024 tomorrow night beginning at 6 o'clock on your KPR One stations. 60% chance of rain tonight, chance of thunderstorms, lows in the upper 40s, mostly cloudy tomorrow morning, becoming mostly sunny by the afternoon with a high in the upper 50s. It's 63 degrees in Lawrence, 65 in Atchison. It is 420.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. There are lots of places to follow election results tomorrow. Your local public radio station is one. Another is social media. Many of the biggest platforms are more lenient about what people can say than during the last presidential election. And that makes misinformation researchers nervous about the spread of lies or even violence. NPR tech correspondent Bobby Allen is here to tell us more. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Ari.
So how are social media companies preparing for the election?
Well, most of the big platforms say they'll be vigilant for any voter interference attempts and false claims of victory. And this will be through a mix of automated systems and human moderators. Google and Meta also are limiting the time frame when advertisers can buy new election ads. So most of the major tech companies say they do have guardrails in place to combat election-related bad actors. But as you mentioned, social media researchers are very skeptical. And this is because they have been noticing companies backing off of commitments and enforcing policies less. And a lot has changed since the last presidential election in 2020.
Tell us more about that. What's changed?
Well, the most obvious change is Twitter, now X. Elon Musk has transformed the platform into a megaphone for the re-election of Donald Trump. And with that has come droves of MAGA fans and very few content rules that would otherwise have taken down false claims about the election. But elsewhere, Ari, other platforms have also become lax. Studies have shown that YouTube has backed off enforcing prior commitments to crack down on videos pushing the big lie, the false idea that the 2020 election was stolen. And many YouTube, TikTok, and ex-provocateurs are going viral by seeding doubt about the 2024 result already. I talked to Marshall Van Alstyne about this. He studies social media at Boston University, and he's really worried about platforms enabling election-related conspiracy theories.
In some sense, they're greasing the skids for violence or greasing the skids for conspiracy theories. I'm hoping it's nothing of the same scale as what we observed in January 6th, but we may be seeing some bad behavior ex post as people believe that their votes weren't counted or that certain districts were stolen from them.
Is he talking about authentic posts by real social media users or paid ads or what?
Yeah, you know, really both, because ads have also been a problem. For instance, dark money groups have been spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on Facebook pushing ads with just outright brazen lies, like that the election might be postponed or that Kamala Harris could drop out.
There was so much misinformation in the last couple presidential elections. Why would the rules be looser now than they were then?
Yeah, counterintuitive, isn't it? It's just really hard, Ari, to overstate just how much of a ripple effect Elon Musk's X has had in terms of, you know, setting the tone for all the platforms. researchers say X has become something of a free-for-all with, you know, very few consequences from Washington. And that has given other social media sites permission to just be looser with their rules. In fact, this tech reform group called the Free Press released a study just days ago, and it found that nearly all of the social media platforms are, quote, backsliding on commitments they made in the wake of the 2020 election. So that's been concerning to social media researchers. And another concern, Ari, is the encrypted messaging app Telegram. We're seeing very large groups there forming to discuss ways of questioning the outcome of the presidential election. And Telegram is another app known for its handoff approach to content moderation. So in short, be very careful on social media tomorrow and after the election.
Will do. NPR's Bobby Allen. Thank you.
Thanks, Ari.
In his third run for the White House, former President Donald Trump is once again delivering a closing message that promises a stronger economy and a strong border. But mixed in that is a darker message with a lot of anger and promises of revenge and retribution, calling political opponents the, quote, enemy within. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has this report on the evolution of Trump's closing argument.
At an extremely late final rally in Grand Rapids, Michigan, back in 2016, then-candidate Donald Trump called for a middle-class rebellion before turning to his bread-and-butter issue.
I just want to ask you one question, if you don't mind, at 1 o'clock in the morning. Who is going to pay for the wall?
4 years later, soon after recovering from COVID, Trump returned to Grand Rapids, where he minimized the dangers of the pandemic and complained about the investigations against him.
We've worked very hard in 4 years. We've been hit by fake investigations, fake scandals, fake impeachments. We've had so many things that... The witch hunt. I call it the witch hunt.
But now, ahead of his third trip to Grand Rapids, his rhetoric has turned even darker, and it's more focused on domestic enemies. This weekend, he said he wouldn't mind if reporters were shot, and doubled down on suggestions that Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney should have to fire in combat.
And if you gave Liz Cheney a gun and put her into battle facing the other side with guns pointing at her, she wouldn't have the courage or the strength or the stamina to even look the enemy in the eye.
Let me just say that emotions are always high at the end of a campaign. Candidates on both sides are known to push the limits. But Trump's violent imagery and focus on domestic enemies, while thrilling supporters, has political scholars drawing comparisons to former strongmen of the past.
I hear a lot of echoes of Mussolini's fascism in Trump's rhetoric.
Jennifer Murcia is a professor at Texas A&M University who studies political rhetoric. She says Trump's language has intensified, and so have his promises. She notes several top military national security officials who worked in the Trump administration have raised similar concerns, including his former chief of staff, who said Trump meets the definition of a fascist.
These are people who worked with him closely. They know exactly what Trump is like because they were the ones that protected the rule of law and democracy in America when Trump was trying to violate those things.
The Trump campaign says the concerns about fascism are overblown and Biden and Harris are the real threat to democracy. They call these attacks dishonest attempts to discredit conservatives and their ideas. That's certainly how many of Trump's supporters feel.
It's nonsense. I'm the man on the street. We're in small-town America, rural America, and it hurts, okay? The message doesn't resonate positively with me at all. It's negative.
Peter Fabry is a retired Cadillac designer. He says the accusations are an attempt by the Democrats to distract from a lack of policy solutions. He and his wife also run a small business in northern Michigan, which he says did well under Trump, but never fully recovered after COVID. He blames the Biden-Harris administration.
So those 4 years of Trump brought prosperity, and we were able to make money and put money in the bank. And then followed by the COVID and the 4 years with the Biden-Harris administration, we didn't make any money. We've been struggling.
And some Republican strategists, like Alex Conant, say don't let Trump's rhetoric distract from the policies.
When you look at his core platform, it's lower taxes, it's more restrictions on immigration, it's stronger national defense.
Conant, who helped lead Senator Marco Rubio's presidential campaign back in 2016, says the policy platform looks a lot like Mitt Romney's in 2012.
This is a very traditional conservative campaign, just with Donald Trump's more extremist rhetoric, which makes it different.
But that's when Trump stays on script. And when he closes out his campaign tonight in Grand Rapids for a third time, whether he stays on script or veers off may determine whether he distracts from his own final message. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, Grand Rapids, Michigan.
This is NPR News.
As Americans hold their breath awaiting the end of another contentious election, TV news executives say they are ready-ish.
We have really made a sincere effort to get out there around the country and to understand the electorate.
This story and analysis of all things election-related on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning, 5 to 9 a.m. on your KPR stations for the latest election news and a whole lot more. Jay Schaefer will be your local host.
Support for KPR comes from Blue Collar Press. Blue Collar Press has been helping businesses, musicians, and artists, big and small, turn ideas into promotional merchandise for 20 years. More information at bluecollarpress.com.
News headlines are up next. 63 degrees in Lawrence, 65 in Topeka, 59 in Abilene. It is 4:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, the benefits of encountering the unexpected. For toddlers, anyway.
There was this really big learning boost for kids who had seen the impossible event.
Also, is the U.S. more prepared for a contested election than we were 4 years ago?
That story is after these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. All 435 seats in the House of Representatives are on the ballot, but only about 15% of those contests are considered competitive. NPR's Deirdre Walsh says it may take days to know which party will have the majority in Congress.
House races in a couple of largely blue states, California and New York, could determine which party has control of the chamber, and it may take a while to count ballots in some of the tight California contests. Republicans hold a narrow majority, and Democrats need to pick up a total of 4 seats to tip the balance. House Speaker Mike Johnson is predicting full GOP control of Washington, with Trump in the White House and Republican majorities in both the House and Senate. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries has been more cautious, but if Democrats prevail in the chamber, he's positioned to become the nation's first black Speaker of the House. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, Washington.
Well, Massachusetts voters will choose whether to legalize certain psychedelic drugs when they head to the polls tomorrow. As Walter Wolfman of member station WBUR reports, Massachusetts would be the third state to allow people to grow and use hallucinogens.
The law would legalize natural psychedelic substances for use in licensed therapy centers. Advocates point to research showing psychedelics' potential as a treatment for conditions like depression and PTSD. Michu Oliveira is an activist who says she currently grows and administers psilocybin mushrooms illegally.
People are already doing this. It's already happening. So now you need to have people that have experience come together and create something that is viable.
Opponents argue these drugs can be harmful for certain people and fear an expanded black market of homegrown psychedelics. For NPR News, I'm Walter Wuthman in Boston.
The Fed is widely expected to cut its short-term interest rate by 0.25% this week. That announcement comes on Thursday, 2 days after voting ends in the general election. This is NPR News.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Election Day is tomorrow, but more than 500,000 Kansans have already voted. Kansas Secretary of State Scott Schwab says he expects turnout this cycle to exceed that in the 2016 presidential election. All seats in the Kansas legislature are up for grabs this election, and newly minted citizens could be a deciding factor in some of those races. More than 2,000 immigrants become citizens in Kansas each year. Many are excited about casting a ballot this cycle. We'll have more on that story later in the program. The recent E. coli outbreak sickened at least 5 people in the Kansas City area, including a 12-year-old child. The Kansas City Health Department says the local victims experienced severe stomach cramps, nausea, and vomiting. KCTV reports that three were hospitalized for up to a week. Four of the five cases in Kansas City have been linked to the multi-state outbreak connected with McDonald's hamburgers, specifically the diced onions used in quarter pounder sandwiches. Hundreds of people in Kansas are waiting for life-saving organ transplants. Jan Finn is CEO of the Midwest Transplant Network, which is the main organ procurement agency for Kansas and parts of Missouri. She says approximately 2,500 people in Kansas and Missouri are awaiting new organs. One of her group's main challenges is fighting misconceptions about organ donation.
We try to address those right off the bat, that they can have an open casket, that organ donation should not interfere with any final plans that they have. Organ donation does not cost anything to the donor family.
Finn says they try to combat negative stereotypes about organ donation and that for the most part, Kansans are receptive. She says most people in their service area are noted as organ donors on their driver's licenses. The Kansas City Chiefs, the only undefeated team in the NFL, line up tonight against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at Arrowhead Stadium. Sam Zeff provided this preview.
The Bucs come into Arrowhead with a 4-4 record and a two-game losing streak, but in the last three games, Tampa Bay has had 300 yards passing and 100 yards rushing, which has defensive coordinator Steve Spagnuolo worried.
I keep waiting for a game when I put the film on and it's not a top offense we're playing. These guys are good. I'm really impressed with the three backs. The quarterback's playing really good.
Buccaneers quarterback Baker Mayfield has 21 touchdown passes this season and 9 interceptions. Patrick Mahomes has 8 TD passes and 9 picks. I'm Sam Zeff.
We do have a 60% chance of rain tonight with a chance of thunderstorms. Lows tonight in the upper 40s. Tomorrow mostly cloudy in the morning, becoming mostly sunny. Highs tomorrow in the upper 50s. It's 63 degrees in Lawrence, 63 in Emporia, 64 in Chanute. It's 435.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Just a few hours to go now before Election Day and determining who will be the next president of the United States. But with polls showing an extremely tight race, a narrow victory by either candidate could open up the possibility of a contested election. That could mean legal challenges or, more worrying, the possibility of post-election political violence like we saw on January 6th. After that failed attempt to subvert the election results, three retired U.S. generals wrote in the Washington Post, quote, "We are chilled to our bones at the thought of a coup succeeding next time." Next time as in now, as in 2024. Well, Army Major General Paul Eaton was one of the authors of that piece, and when I spoke to him today, I asked what lessons the military has learned since last time around.
Murphy's Law is, if it can go wrong, it will go wrong at the worst possible time. The notice to the military that 1-6 provided was we had some folks who, as veterans and a handful of active duty, behave badly.
Hmm.
We have gone deep into the psyche of the commands, and there has been a considerable effort to identify any notion of extremism, any notion that the oath that we all swore to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that is clearly understood, the chain of command is clearly understood, and that national and local security forces are to be counted upon to do the right thing.
Yeah.
We expect absolutely that will be the case.
To pick up on what you just raised about chain of command, the military, as you know better than anyone, is trained. Salute, you follow your orders. What happens in a scenario in which the military is trying to follow orders, but you have a contested election and more than one person may be claiming to be commander-in-chief?
Mary Louise, that is precisely the question that occurred when we were doing our own analysis. The notion that someone will declare victory early, that possibility has become more likely as we see the behaviors in President Trump. And at that point, we simply say, well, the election is underway. We have not counted all votes, and we expect that the executive branch and that all states' polling places and counting locations are going to be alert to that possibility, yet they will continue to drive on, count the votes, so that we can have a certifiable election.
So let me just ask directly the basic question of how worried are you? And I will frame that in this context. Other retired officers have been raising concerns around this year's election. One of them is another retired Army general who you probably know, Joe Votel. He just took part in a University of Pennsylvania study that gamed out the aftermath of a contested election. That report concluded, and I quote, "Civil unrest in the face of the 2024 presidential election and beyond is a realistic, if not likely, possibility." Realistic, if not likely. How does that line up against your expectations?
Yes, I do know Joe Votel, and he is one of our finest, most sober leaders. I admire him greatly, and I absolutely agree. It is a possibility. And we in the military go to the worst case possibility. What's the worst that can happen? And then you organize and plan on how you will mitigate that. I expect our state and local law authorities are going to be thoroughly involved in this, as well as our National Guard throughout the nation. And I expect that federal forces, to include the military, are equally prepared and have planned for the possibility that you could have civil unrest and it could be substantial.
You described the worst case scenario, that it's the job of the military to prep for the worst case. What's the best case? That the military is, we're just not thinking about them at all after the election because it's so not even in play?
Well, the military will always have a place to defend our vital national interest. And domestic security, I would say, is our vital national interest.
That is retired U.S. Army Major General Paul Eaton. General Eaton, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary Louise.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at Hidden Brain. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Brian Perkins. A few years ago, Perkins started using a cane to walk.
Now, the thing about walking with a cane is that you've only got one hand to carry stuff. And so this was just post-pandemic. I had dropped off a bunch of clothes at the dry cleaners to get done and had just gone back to pick them up. And I was standing at the counter with my cane, and I was paying, and clearly had more than I could carry in one hand out. And this woman, she was sitting by the laundromat and looked at me, and she said, "Do you need any help?" And I said, no, I've got it, I've got it. And so I hobbled out to my truck and was just getting through putting it in the back seat when I turned around and I looked, and there she was marching out of the dry cleaners with the rest of my laundry in her hands. And she put it in the truck, and she looked at me, and she said, "I know you. You've been helping people all your life. Now it's your turn. Accept it." And just like that, she walked away. Now, to be clear, I didn't know this woman. I had never met her, and I'd never seen her before. But her words had a ripple effect on my life. I learned that it was okay to accept help. And so, over the years, and it's been a few years, I've gone from being grateful to my one unsung hero to having a whole chorus of unsung heroes who've helped me in many little ways and made a difference in my life. And learn that people like to help other people, and that kindness is not something that's forgotten. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful.
Brian Perkins of Biddeford, Maine. You can find more stories of unsung heroes at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Midi Health, committed to providing a supported path to symptom relief for women in perimenopause and menopause, offering personalized virtual care. Learn more at joinmidi.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Among the things Florida is voting on is a proposal that would overturn the state's ban on most abortions after 6 weeks. Instead, it would guarantee the right to an abortion in the state constitution. Florida Republicans, including Governor Ron DeSantis, have made several attempts to thwart the proposed amendment. Here's Regan McCarthy of member station WFSU.
Caroline recently found herself in the middle of two quickly brewing storms. One came from political pushback to a story she shared about her abortion.
I was also packing up my house to evacuate for Milton.
Caroline is talking about Hurricane Milton, which crashed into Florida in early October. We're not using her last name to protect her safety. Back in 2022, when she was about 18 weeks pregnant, Caroline learned she had a brain tumor.
The best chance of survival would be with the chemo and radiation, and all I wanted to do was leave the neuro ICU and go home to my almost two-year-old girl.
Caroline's story was featured in a television ad supporting Florida's proposed abortion amendment.
The doctors knew if I did not end my pregnancy, I would lose my baby, I would lose my life, and my daughter would lose her mom. Florida has now banned abortion, even in cases like mine.
The Florida Department of Health took issue with that last line in a cease and desist letter sent to television stations airing the ad. Florida's current law bans most abortions after 6 weeks, but it includes exceptions, such as protecting the life of the pregnant person.
These are not real exceptions.
Dr. Chelsea Daniels works for Planned Parenthood in Miami.
A simple exception clause, politician without a medical background, does not take into account how medically complex patients can be and how clinically nuanced different situations can be.
Supporters of the amendment say Florida's ban endangers women by making access to abortion harder and by creating confusion and fear for doctors. Opponents argue the proposed amendment would put pregnant people in danger, and they say it's the abortion advocates who are causing confusion.
Well, thank you so much. Please.
Republican Governor Ron DeSantis calls the amendment extreme.
There's a lot in this that is not something that most people would find acceptable. And regardless of even what the opinion on it is, you know, these are things that are just flat out wrong to put in a constitution.
The DeSantis administration is behind a series of efforts to thwart the amendment, such as an investigation into alleged petition fraud, including police knocking on the doors of some people who signed to get the proposal on the ballot, and an ad and website published by the state's Agency for Healthcare Administration that says the amendment, quote, threatens women's safety. Amendment supporters say this is all an effort to mislead voters, but DeSantis pushes back on that idea.
What it is it's providing information about what Florida law is and the resources that are available under that law. They don't like that because they're lying about what's in Florida law.
We aren't telling lies. We're talking about facts. We have the stories of Florida women who have been denied this kind of care.
Lauren Brinzel heads Floridians Protecting Freedom, the campaign behind the state's proposed abortion amendment.
Our plan is to share the stories and not fall into the trap that is getting distracted by counter narratives, because we know we're in the right here.
Florida's amendment needs 60% approval to pass. Abortion advocates see it as a chance to ensure abortion access not only for women in Florida, but for pregnant people throughout the Southeast. For NPR News, I'm Regan McCarthy in Tallahassee.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we bring you the latest on everything from the presidential race to what interest rates are doing. But we also share stories that take us into other people's lives.
You actually played your horn while they were inside your skull.
Absolutely. Doesn't everybody?
Listen for the unexpected with the news weekdays on Morning Edition.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. Jay Schaefer will be your local host. From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 99.5 FM in Manhattan, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Dole Institute of Politics, hosting former Congressman Luke Messer and Sherry Bustos for their series Congress in the 21st Century, Wednesday, November 13th, 4 p.m. More at doleinstitute.org.
Stay with us. Coming up in our next half hour, the campaign is pretty much over. Reporters who covered it reflect on their time on the trail as Election Day is tomorrow. Candidates delivering their final pitches to voters. We'll get you all the details coming right up.
72% of NPR listeners value public radio as an important community service. Support your community and promote your business by sponsoring KPR. Learn more at sponsorship.kansaspublicradio.org.
We have a flood watch through this evening for Allen, Greenwood, Neosho, Wilson, and Woodson counties. That does include the city of Chanute. Otherwise, 60% chance of rain tonight with a chance of thunderstorms. Lows overnight in the upper 40s. It's 63 degrees in Lawrence at 10 minutes before 5.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers. Control of the U.S. Senate could come down to voters in mostly red Montana. There, Democratic Senator John Tester is in a tight race with Republican challenger Tim Sheehy. Tester is the last Democrat holding statewide office. On the same ballot, Montana voters are also deciding whether to amend the state's constitution to enshrine abortion protections. Montana Public Radio's Shaylee Rager took a road trip across the state.
Along the Yellowstone River sits Livingston, a picturesque gateway to Yellowstone National Park, and it's seen an influx of new residents like much of western Montana. That includes Katie Williams, who moved from South Dakota about 2 years ago.
I love it here.
Williams first spoke to Montana Public Radio about her views in early October. Back then, she was considering how to vote on a state ballot initiative to protect abortion access. While abortion remains legal in the state, voters will decide this election whether to guarantee abortion rights in the state constitution.
People are allowed to make their own decisions. You know, like even Jesus would have said, like, you free will, you have free choice.
On Tuesday, Williams plans to vote yes on that measure. Yet just this week, she said she doesn't plan to vote in the presidential election, saying she doesn't like any candidate and doesn't think it'll make a difference. Polls show former President Donald Trump is leading in Montana, a state he won by double digits in 2020 and 2016. Business owner and former Navy SEAL Tim Sheehy, boosted by an early endorsement from Trump, is the Republican candidate for Senate. For voters like Pete Liza in southwestern Ennis, that endorsement is important. The Army veteran retired from the Boston Fire Department and moved to Montana 10 years ago. He said he wanted to live in a more conservative state and can't believe how tight the Sheehy-Tester contest is.
And I'd like to see Sheehy win.
Liza said Sheehy and the GOP represent his values well.
I just think that I've been for the flag, for the country, and I just think one party represents that a lot better than the other.
Questions about the origins of a gunshot wound have trailed Sheehy since last spring. He says he was wounded while serving in Afghanistan, but 2015 records show he told a park ranger he'd accidentally shot himself in a national park. Democrats often point to that discrepancy, saying Sheehy isn't trustworthy. Polls show that Sheehy is ahead of Tester. If Tester, a three-term incumbent, is to win this cycle, he needs voters like the Livingston voter, Williams. She's not sold on either party. Williams says she decided in the past few weeks to vote for Tester. She says she wants
someone that you can trust and that's an honest person, because you don't find that a lot in politics.
Democrats are hoping that the ballot initiative to protect abortion access will also help turn out voters in his favor. Heading north to Montana's capital city, Helena, the Last Chance Community Powwow took place last month. Rose Butler of Cherokee and Shawnee Heritage drove over from Deer Lodge, about an hour away. Butler is originally from Anaconda, a former copper mining town with once strong unions. She said her parents were loyal Democrats.
My dad always told me if you sweat for a living, you vote Democrat. But seeing where the Democrat Party has went, he'd be rolling over in his grave.
But she credits Tester for caring about the same issues she cares about, like access to public lands and protecting veterans' health care.
My husband's a vet. He's had better care under Tester than, you know, any other person that was out there handling things.
Butler was leaning towards Tester last month, but now she plans to vote for Sheehy in person on Tuesday, as well as Trump. She said she wants to see Republicans gain a majority in the Senate to help pass Trump's priorities if he wins. For NPR News, I'm Shaylee Reiger in Helena, Montana.
Chances are you will never eat green eggs and ham. It's improbable, though not impossible. Now, there's evidence that even toddlers can tell the unlikely from the unimaginable. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
Infants know that when a ball rolls off a table, it's certain to fall. But a team, including Lisa Feigenson of Johns Hopkins University, wondered how children assess events that are less predictable.
We wanted to know how little kids think about possibilities.
The team studied more than 300 2- and 3-year-olds. Feigenson says the first challenge was getting their attention.
But it turns out that the opportunity to, like, put a little coin into a machine and get a prize is very naturally motivating to kids.
So the scientists filled the gumball machine with toys and started handing out coins. When a toddler got a toy, they were told it had a made-up name, like Blick. Later, they were asked to identify the Blick from a lineup. Feigenson says when the toddlers knew the machine contained even one or two Blicks, they usually forgot its name.
Any time that it was possible that something could happen, even if it was really improbable, those kids learned quite poorly.
But Feigenson says the result was different when toddlers got a Blick from a machine that appeared to have none.
The really gratifying moments are when kids' eyes widen and their jaws drop and they look at their mom in surprise that this has happened.
It seemed impossible. And then, she says, they usually did remember the Blick's name.
There was this really big learning boost for kids who had seen the impossible event. Those kids are, like, really motivated to learn about that toy.
The study appears in the journal PNAS. Andrew Stolman of Occidental College says it confirms that even very young children learn better when they encounter the unexpected.
It elicits a level of surprise that leads to more attention, better encoding of the events, and better retention of those events later on.
But Stolman says kids are less able to distinguish improbable from impossible events when there's no physical evidence, just a concept, like green eggs and ham.
And the youngest children say all of the events could not happen in real life. Anything that violates their expectations, they deny is possible.
Overall, though, Stolman says this sort of research contains a powerful message.
Maybe if you want children to learn something deeply and for a long time, you violate their expectations prior to introducing that information.
Once they understand how an event occurred, though, they tend to lose interest. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Speaking of improbable versus impossible, here's a familiar thought experiment. If you had an infinite number of monkeys with typewriters, or one monkey with infinite time, would they eventually type out the complete works of William Shakespeare?
This is 1,000 monkeys working at 1,000 typewriters. Soon, they'll have written the greatest novel known to man.
The Simpsons pondered this, so did two mathematicians from the University of Technology, Sydney, in Australia. Stephen Woodcock and Jay Folletta calculated that, based on the current chimpanzee population, it almost certainly wouldn't happen before the universe is expected to collapse.
Their paper in the journal Franklin Open says the widely accepted conclusion from the infinite monkeys theorem is misleading in our finite universe. In fact, the authors found just a 5% possibility that a single chimp would spell out the word bananas within its lifetime.
Which, I guess, itself is kind of bananas.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from National Geographic Documentary Films, presenting Endurance, Endurance follows a team of modern-day explorers who face the Herculean task of finding Sir Ernest Shackleton's famous sunken ship, now streaming on Hulu and Disney+. From Easy Cater, working to help organizations order food online from a nationwide network of restaurants, with tools designed to help save time and manage food spend all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Hi, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv, Ukraine. Wherever the story takes us, NPR does whatever it takes to get the story right. This is NPR.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. Stay tuned. Two more hours of All Things Considered yet to come. We start things off with news headlines. The time is 5 o'clock.
We have momentum. It is on our side. Can you feel it?
It's the final full day of the 2024 campaign.
Vice President Harris and former President Trump are making their closing arguments.
For Monday, November 4th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. First to Denver, where some high schoolers are using AI to make voting easier for those whose first language is not English.
I want to connect to more people to let them know that, like, their vote really matters and that it should be heard.
Later, to a Kansas City area church that's working to bring down the temperature of political rhetoric.
We're trying to blanket Kansas City in love, compassion, understanding, and just calm down.
And we'll look at the science behind the headlines with NPR's Shortwave podcast.
Those stories and more coming up after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. On this final day of a dizzying 2024 presidential campaign, both Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are out trying to mobilize voters. As NPR's Asma Holland reports, the Harris campaign is also trying to manage expectations.
On a call with reporters, Harris's campaign chair, Jen O'Malley Dillon, tried to preemptively explain that election night results may be slow coming in.
We're going to continue to see new votes being reported for many days after Election Day, and that's obviously not a sign of fraud. It's just the way it works.
They expect most results from Georgia, North Carolina, and Michigan will be in by the end of the night, but states have different rules for counting ballots. The comments come as Republicans are filing several lawsuits about voting rules that opponents say are about setting up election challenges. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
The FBI is operating a national election command post in Washington this week. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports staffers will be working round the clock to respond to threats and coordinate with state partners.
About 80 people will be working at the election command post. James Barnicle is deputy assistant director of the FBI's criminal division.
The purpose of the command post is to ensure the FBI is well positioned to respond to threats that would come in or information that would come in that would affect our election security.
The FBI is on the lookout for criminal threats aimed at election workers, plots by foreign adversaries, cyber threats, and acts of violence by domestic extremists. Officials will triage those tips and work with 55 field offices to share information with state and local partners across the country. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
The economy has been a major issue in this race. Trump has proposed cutting taxes on Social Security and imposing sharply higher tariffs on foreign-made goods. Harris is proposing increasing child tax credits and addressing the housing crisis to help first-time buyers. Meanwhile, the election also a big decision for many voters, as well as for a big economic week. Here's NPR's Scott Horsley.
Federal Reserve officials gather in Washington this week, and the central bank is widely expected to cut its benchmark interest rate by a quarter percentage point. The announcement will come on Thursday, 2 days after voting ends in the presidential contest. Striking machinists at Boeing are casting votes today on a tentative contract to end their walkout, now in its eighth week. The proposal calls for 38% pay raises over the next 4 years. OPEC and its allies are extending caps on oil production through the end of the year. The news gave a modest lift to crude oil prices, but retail gasoline prices in the U.S. continue to fall. AAA says the average price of regular gas is now $3.10 a gallon, 32 cents lower than this time last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Three Chinese astronauts have returned to Earth after a six-month stay aboard the country's Tiangong space station. Parachutes slowed their capsule's descent today, bringing it to a safe landing in China's Inner Mongolia region. Crew emerged shortly after 1:24 a.m. local time. The space station is part of China's efforts to become a global leader in space exploration. Federal officials in Brazil say they've wrapped up a 2-year investigation into the murders of a journalist and an indigenous activist in the Amazon. The murders shocked the South American country and drew global attention to the lawlessness and criminal organizations operating in the rainforest. NPR's Kerry Kahn has that story.
Federal police say they've implicated 9 people, including the mastermind of the double homicide of Dom Phillips and Bruno Pereira back in June of 2022. Phillips, a British journalist, and Pereira, a well-known indigenous rights activist, were murdered in the Javari Valley, an indigenous region of the Amazon known to be under assault from illegal fishing and organized crime groups. Officials say Pereira was killed because of his activism in the region. They say the man who directed and financed the murders, including concealing the bodies, is in custody. Police did not publish the name of the alleged mastermind, but local media has long identified him as a suspected illegal fisherman and poacher. Kerry Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
The United Arab Emirates has launched its annual energy summit meeting by announcing plans to increase energy output, even with pledges of being moving away from climate-warming fossil fuels after last year's COP28 climate talks. The UAE says it will increase oil production by about 5 million barrels a day. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt. Through the Schmidt Family Foundation, work resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Woodhaven, Inc., manufacturing custom deck and siding solutions using sustainable woods and powered exclusively by wind energy. Located in Perry, with shipping available to the entire KPR listening area. Details at woodhavenproducts.com.
62 degrees in Lawrence, 58 in Manhattan. It is 5:06.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. The 2024 presidential election is almost over, and the candidates are making the most of the remaining hours. Former President Donald Trump is bouncing between the battleground states of Michigan, North Carolina, and, of course, Pennsylvania.
But we have to turn out and vote tomorrow. We're going to vote.
Vice President Kamala Harris is spending the whole of her day in must-win Pennsylvania, stumping in Pittsburgh, Allentown, and Scranton.
Let's get out the vote!
Harris's day ends with a concert in the state's biggest city, Philadelphia, of course. NPR's White House correspondents Tamara Keith and Franco Ordonez have been covering all of it. And for the next few minutes, they're here with us to look back. Hi to both of you.
Hello.
Hey, Juana.
Franco, I want to start with you. There have been just a whole lot of ups and downs in this campaign, but if you remember, there was a point in this race where former President Trump, he looked almost unbeatable.
Yeah, for sure. And I'd say that moment was following the debate with President Biden and going into the Republican National Convention. I mean, it's really hard to imagine a debate going worse for Biden. It led to the end of his campaign. And then there was the assassination attempt that happened in Pennsylvania. It was a scary moment. But Trump got up, he lifted his fist, he yelled, fight, fight, fight. And that became the iconic moment and the rallying cry for the rest of his campaign. I mean, he went into that convention, the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, with just unbelievable momentum.
That's right. And then President Biden made the decision to drop out of the race. Tam, over to you. How did that change the momentum for Democrats?
It was a tectonic shift. Harris quickly locked down the nomination. And then early on in her candidacy, I remember being on Air Force Two when she landed at the Detroit airport for a rally. And looking out the window, it was clear that this was going to be huge. As we waited for Harris to exit the plane, her staff were on the tarmac, dancing, like literally dancing, okay. As a DJ entertained this crowd of 15,000 people. You know, this was a pure joy moment for her campaign and her supporters, and a huge sigh of relief and just outright euphoria for Democrats who had been facing such grim prospects. You know, this rally and others like it in the earliest days of Harris's candidacy had such a high level of enthusiasm. It was like something Democrats hadn't seen since Obama.
Yeah, if I can just jump in, I'll say that that same time period was also Trump's toughest period. I mean, really, for 5 or 6 weeks, the Trump campaign really struggled. I mean, he was just caught flat-footed and unable to counter. It was just a massive shift in the race. And Tam and I have been talking about how Trump was really stuck on focusing on Biden.
Yeah.
It kind of robbed him of, you know, the easy walk to the presidency that he thought he was going to have. I mean, he kept talking about a coup, and that kind of hurt him because he was unable to, or at least very slow, to adapt to his new opponent.
Okay, so that was Trump's biggest challenge. Tam, what would you say the toughest moment was for Vice President Harris?
For Harris, it was like the joy phase turned into the grind phase in October. She hit a skid when she went on The View for what should have been an easy interview, and she didn't have an answer to the question of what she would do differently from President Biden. She still doesn't have a great answer to that, and it has become a regular feature of campaign ads from Trump and his allies.
Vice President Harris has spent most of this campaign talking about herself as the underdog, describing herself as such. What is she saying on that now?
Well, the underdog phrasing is gone. It dropped out of her speech a few days ago. Then over the weekend, her campaign announced it was ending on a positive note, and she stopped directly referring to Trump in her remarks. I don't know if this is real confidence or projecting confidence, but she is saying she will win.
And we have the momentum because our campaign is tapping into the ambitions, the aspirations, and the dreams of the American people.
Franco, tell us, what has the mood been like within the Trump campaign in these closing days of the race?
Well, I mean, I'll say the Trump campaign is also projecting a lot of confidence. I mean, they point me to polls that show him doing better than he did in 2016 and 2020 at this point. I mean, Trump was behind in those races at this time. I mean, but the candidate, former President Donald Trump, it is a different story. I mean, he's really unleashing some of his darkest rhetoric of the campaign. I mean, he really just keeps going off script and just unloading on all these grievances.
To get me, somebody would have to shoot through the fake news. And I don't mind that so much.
I mean, having covered Trump for most of the last decade, we know how he lashes out, and he does that often when he feels vulnerable.
The three of us have covered a lot of campaigns between us, many of those together. Tam, I want to start with you with all of the campaigns you've covered over the years. What's going to stick with you from this one?
Yeah, on Friday, I was in the pool traveling with Vice President Harris in Wisconsin. And that night, she had a huge rally in Milwaukee. But what sticks out to me is the rally earlier in the day in Little Chute, population 12,000. This was a county that Trump won by 10 points 4 years ago. And on the drive in, there was this large crowd of Trump supporters waving flags and banners. But then as we got closer, there was this big line of Harris voters who couldn't get into the rally because the school gymnasium was already overfilled. That enthusiasm was very real. The Harris campaign has talked a lot about working to lose by less in red and purple counties, and that's what this was all about. We won't know until the results come in whether that moment speaks to a larger trend or not.
Franco, what about you? What will you remember most?
I mean, I'd say win or lose, I think it's just a shocking political comeback that Trump's made. After stoking the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, the multiple indictments, all the scandals, and then to be today knocking on the door to be the first convicted felon to win the White House.
NPR's Franco Ordonez and Tamara Keith, thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
In the Amazon rainforest, it's been the driest year in more than a century. Throughout South America, countries are grappling with less water, battling record wildfires, and rationing energy as hydropower generation plummets. Millions of people who depend on the rivers and tributaries have seen their livelihoods sink along with the water levels. NPR's Kerry Kahn brings us this report from Manaus, the largest city in Brazil's Amazon.
From his small stall at Manaus' raucous indoor fish market, Dantas Abreu has a unique perspective on how this huge port city has changed in just one generation. He has two kids. One is 26, the other 2.5. The big gap, definitely a surprise, he says. Being a dad at 50, it's way different. 25 years ago, there weren't cell phones or computers, but today my 2-year-old cries if I don't give her my smartphone, he says. Also, 2 decades ago, there was lots of fish in the rivers, he says, and money flowed easily, too. But these last 2 years have been devastating, nothing he's ever seen before.
Baixada do Rio sumiu, peixe. Aumentou tudo, tá entendendo?
The river dropped, and so did the amount of fish. Everything costs more now, he says.
Muito difícil, muito difícil. A nossa situação aqui no Amazonas está muito difícil.
It's so difficult here in Amazonas, Brazil's largest state by area in the rainforest, he says. Just as a customer starts haggling over the cost of a kilo of his pirarucu fillets.
Deixa que eu ainda vou comprar verdura, quem sabe eu volto.
He won't budge, and she retreats, saying she'll just stock up on more vegetables. Abreu says he's lost half his clientele. Never has there been so little recorded rainfall in the Amazon, the world's largest river system and the Earth's most important carbon-absorbing region. Scientists point to the rise in global temperatures as well as a stronger-than-normal El Niño weather pattern for the devastating dryness now stretching into a second year. João Arroldo Vieira takes a small boat out of one of Manaus' busiest ports. He stops mid-river and cuts the engine. Here the black waters of the Rio Negro and the murky Amazon meet, but don't mix, in a spectacular contrast. Vieira also points out the river's dry, exposed banks.
Essa praia aqui era pequena, tio. Aí já aumentou pra cá.
We're right in front of a huge sandbar that has appeared in recent years, and with every drought, he says, it gets higher and higher and bigger, and it extends further into the river.
Triste porque está diminuindo o rio, né? A água está sumindo, está crescendo as terras. Ficando com pouco rio para a gente andar.
It's sad to see the river like this, he says. It's getting smaller, and the land keeps growing. There's not enough river left for us to move about, he adds. Whole communities have been left stranded. Residents are dependent on the Amazon's mighty rivers and tributaries to move everything in this state with few roads. And lower river levels mean fewer ferries can cross, and with lighter loads. The government has rushed out more transportation boats and has begun dredging the Amazon in hopes of widening passageways. November usually begins the rainy season, but most, like Manaus fishmonger Dantas Abreu, are anxious. Meteorologists are skeptical that the upcoming rains will be enough to make up for this long 2-year drought.
O homem, né? O homem tá acabando a natureza. E a natureza tá dando a sua resposta, né?
Man has destroyed nature, he says, and nature is now just answering back. Kerry Kahn, NPR News, Manaus, Brazil.
Thank you.
to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is your place for NPR News from the University of Kansas, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 89.9 FM in Atchison, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
Thanks so much for tuning in this evening. We have news headlines coming your way in just about 12 minutes. In our next half hour, we'll learn how some first-time voters could hold the key to major state legislative races this time around. Also, we'll get you the details on Russia's latest efforts to interfere in American elections, all coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from KU School of Music, inviting KU alumni to return to the 100th Annual Vespers Choir, singing alongside fellow alumni while commemorating a century of Vespers tradition on December 8th. Details at music.ku.edu.
Following All Things Considered this evening on your KPR1 stations, we have classical music for you. The beautiful Blue Danube taking center stage tonight. Plus, we'll take a trip to the carnival with Dvorak to get ready for the rest of the week. Join us for Evening Classical with Destiny at 7 o'clock on your KPR1 stations. If you're joining us on KPR2, up next, we have This American Life. 60% chance of rain tonight with a chance of storms. Lows tonight in the upper 40s. Tomorrow mostly cloudy in the morning, becoming mostly sunny with highs in the upper 50s. There's a flood watch through this evening for Allen Greenwood, Neosho Wilson, and Woodson counties.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from National Geographic Documentary Films, presenting Endurance. Endurance follows a team of modern-day explorers who face the Herculean task of finding Sir Ernest Shackleton's famous sunken ship, now streaming on Hulu and Disney+. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Instead of thinking about Election Day tomorrow, you could imagine the election in three phases. There's been early voting. About 80 million people have cast their ballots so far. Then comes the blitz of votes tomorrow. And finally, the counting, which could take days. NPR's Miles Parks is here to walk us through what election officials and security experts are looking for in all three of those phases. Hey, Miles.
Hey, Ari.
Okay, first, early voting. My understanding is that numbers are lower than during the pandemic of 2020, but still very high historically. What else can you tell us about those numbers?
Right. So this is the highest non-pandemic early vote total ever. Mm-hmm. And most of it is coming from early in-person voting, with Republicans specifically coming around to this voting method after the Republican candidate, Donald Trump, kind of gave Republican voters the green light to start voting this way. The open question here is whether it matters, because this could be a lot of people who voted on Election Day in 2020 who just moved those votes a couple days earlier. Experts generally, though, are really happy with how voting is going at this point. One detail that caught my eye this week is there was all this concern about how Hurricane Helene a few weeks ago would impact the election, but counties in North Carolina affected by the hurricane are actually outpacing the rest of the state when it comes to voter turnout.
Wow, that's really good news. So when we look ahead to tomorrow, how many people are expected to turn out and what are officials watching for?
So even though so many people have voted early, roughly half the country is still expected to vote tomorrow. That could be upwards of 70 million people. And any time that many people are doing the same thing on the same day, there will be problems, yeah. Right? Poll workers get sick. Someone's going to forget the keys to a precinct. I was at a briefing last week, and one election official said, a person will drive into a power line outside of a polling place and lose electricity. Somewhere in the country, right? So the question is more, are there trends? One thing I'll be watching for tomorrow is specifically the experience of Spanish-speaking voters. Mm. We have seen former President Trump pushing the lie that non-citizens are going to be voting in big numbers this election. And so voting rights groups are really monitoring to see whether those fears turn into voter intimidation at the polls.
Huh. All right. Well, once voting ends, counting begins, and experts have warned that that is a real period of uncertainty where misinformation can thrive.
What's their message right now? Please give us patience. It takes a lot of time to count hundreds of millions of pieces of paper. So if margins are tight, it may also take time for news outlets like the Associated Press to call a winner. And for that reason, when I talk to election officials, they say they're really hoping for the election not to be close. I talked with Neil Makija, who's the chair of the Board of Elections in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, and he said wide margins take a lot of pressure off election officials and also leave less room for interference in the process.
What I hope and what my message is in these final days is really to encourage every voter to make their voice heard so that we end up with an election that is decisive, that cannot be questioned.
Of course, his home state of Pennsylvania is the swing state with the most electoral votes. Are you expecting some of the more decisive states that could determine which way it goes to tally up their results quickly, or could it take a while?
It could definitely take a while. There's some optimism in some states. Michigan, for instance, has made processes a little easier for people for election officials to count. But in other places, specifically Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, the state legislatures in those places have not changed rules to make it easier for election officials to count mail ballots specifically. So that means results could take a while. Obviously, the polls in those states have also shown close to a dead heat. So election officials are gearing up for a very tense week.
As is the country, NPR's Miles Parks, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ari.
Voting in the U.S. can be complicated, especially for newly naturalized citizens whose first language isn't English. Some high school students in Denver, many from immigrant families, are trying to help, and they harnessed the power of artificial intelligence. Experts are praising their efforts, even if there is still concern about AI's accuracy. Colorado Public Radio's Jenny Brundine visited their classroom.
I want you to go to make a voting plan.
The students at DSST College View are 97% students of color, mostly Hispanic, some Vietnamese. In their civics class, after researching who votes and who doesn't, they wanted to do a project to help people less likely to vote. Many have parents who are naturalized citizens, but they're intimidated by the voting process. And senior Daisy Quintana says young people gravitate towards technology.
We were talking about how not many people vote and they have the ability to vote. So I feel like this encouraged us to make this app that could, like, help others want to vote and vote.
The English version of Colorado's Voter Guide is 122 pages this year. There is a Spanish version, but students say the technical language is confusing. It's out of reach, especially for young people and their family members. They wanted to build a simple way to engage disenfranchised voters in multiple languages.
This is where it tells you you can start your journey right here.
Juan Cruz shows me the front page of their app called VoteWise Colorado. Students were divided into work groups like quality control or technical architecture. They built the app and a companion chatbot with their teacher and an industry partner from Tin Man Kinetics. I start asking questions.
Am I registered to vote?
Juan types into the bot, and I am.
Well, it gives us the link to Go Vote Colorado.
That's the official Colorado government site. I ask about individual ballot measures.
Proposition 129 is about establishing veterinary professional associates.
The answers are clear and simple to understand. In the larger world, experts say going to one of the big chatbots for voter information is not a good idea. They can give you incorrect or biased information depending on how you phrase your question. Virginia Tech professor Casey Myers.
As we know with all things AI, there's a real due diligence on behalf of the users to fact check it and to verify what they're being told.
University of Colorado computer scientist Jim Martin is concerned about chatbots oversimplifying pros and cons listed in the state voter guide.
OpenAI decides that, well, this is a good paraphrase, to shorten it or to elaborate. And you don't know whether or not that's consistent with what the legislative intent was.
But Meyer says it looks like the students made their app and bot responsibly with good safeguards. Student Angel Garcia.
Bots like these, we made them trained on what's inside the actual documents, and I feel like it's more a secure way to understand what's happening.
They used a platform called PlayLab, a nonprofit that gives teachers access to large language AI models with guardrails built in. And they followed national safety principles for educators working with AI. That included significant prompting and training focused on getting voters objective information from official sources.
Students say they know the risks of AI, but they also see it as a way to address a problem they saw in their communities. Hector Sanchez Ruiz.
I want to connect to more people to let them know that, like, their vote really matters and that it should be heard.
After all this work, the kids are looking forward to learning election results tomorrow, like everybody else. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundy.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers and discover their ideal profession before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu.
This is NPR News.
As Americans hold their breath awaiting the end of another contentious election, TV news executives say they are ready-ish.
We have really made a sincere effort to get out there around the country and to understand the electorate.
This story and analysis of all things election-related tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning. Start off your election day with Kansas Public Radio Morning Edition, 5 to 9 a.m. Your local host is Jay Schaefer.
KPR listeners are engaged in their communities and they frequent businesses that support public radio. Become a KPR sponsor and reach those most likely to take action at sponsorship.kansaspublicradio.org.
Stay with us. News headlines are up next. 62 degrees in Lawrence, 58 in Abilene, 64 in Chanute. The time is 5:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, our science news roundup from NPR's podcast, Shortwave.
Including the discovery of a tadpole fossil that is more than 160 million years old.
When I saw it under the binocular microscope, I said, this is the best tadpole ever.
Best tadpole ever after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. State lawmakers
one of
play
the final
a crucial
campaign
role
in
former
setting
President
the policies
Donald Trump made today
lives,
was in the swing
was in
state of Ryland, North Carolina.
Tells us,
control
Stephen
of several
Sadler
state legislatures.
We are having a bit of a problem with our feed from NPR. Please stand by. All right, that problem has still not been rectified, so here we are with the regional news. For KPR News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Election Day is tomorrow, but more than 500,000 Kansans have already voted. Kansas Secretary of State Scott Schwab says he expects turnout this cycle to exceed that in the 2016 presidential election. All seats in the Kansas legislature are up for grabs this election, and newly minted citizens could be a deciding factor in some of those races. More than 2,000 immigrants become citizens in Kansas each year. Many are excited about casting a ballot this election cycle. We'll have more on that story in just about 10 minutes here on KPR. The recent E. coli outbreak sickened at least 5 people in the Kansas City area, including a 12-year-old child. The Kansas City Health Department says the local victims experienced severe stomach cramps, nausea, and vomiting. KCTV reports that 3 were hospitalized for up to a week. 4 of the 5 cases in Kansas City have been linked to the multi-state outbreak connected with McDonald's hamburgers, specifically the diced onions used in quarter-pounder sandwiches. Hundreds of people in Kansas are waiting for life-saving organ transplants. Jan Finn is CEO of the Midwest Transplant Network, which is the main organ procurement agency for Kansas and parts of Missouri. She says approximately 2,500 people in Kansas and Missouri are awaiting new organs. One of her group's main challenges is fighting misconceptions about organ donation.
We try to address those right off the bat, that they can have an open casket, that organ donation should not interfere with any final plans that they have. Organ donation does not cost anything to the donor family.
Finn says they try to combat negative stereotypes about organ donation, and for the most part, Kansans are receptive. She says most people in their service area are noted as organ donors on their driver's licenses. Every harvest season means the movement of huge amounts of grain, and as Harvest Public Media's Jim Meadows reports, for those dealing with grain on farms and at elevators, it can be dangerous.
Walking on a pile of grain can be like walking on quicksand, and farm workers have suffocated after sinking into grain inside bins. Stuart Beckman is safety director for Columbia Grain in North Dakota. He says workers who detect an issue inside a bin sometimes ignore the risks.
And then people feel compelled to enter a bin to try and get that grain to move or walk that grain down, and those are very dangerous things, and we do not allow that.
OSHA's Kansas City Regional Office recently added Missouri to the list of states where it's been emphasizing grain handling safety, along with the states of Kansas and Nebraska. I'm Jim Meadows, Harvest Public Media.
The Kansas City Chiefs, the only undefeated team in the NFL, line up tonight against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at Arrowhead Stadium. Sam Zeff provided this preview.
The Bucs come into Arrowhead with a 4-4 record and a 2-game losing streak, but in the last three games, Tampa Bay has had 300 yards passing and 100 yards rushing, which has defensive coordinator Steve Spagnuolo worried.
I keep waiting for a game when I put the film on and it's not a top offense we're playing. These guys are good. I'm really impressed with the three backs. The quarterback's playing really good.
Buccaneers quarterback Baker Mayfield has 21 touchdown passes this season and 9 interceptions. Patrick Mahomes has 8 TD passes and 9 picks. I'm Sam Zeff.
The forecast for northeast and east central Kansas, 60% chance of rain tonight, chance of thunderstorms, lows in the upper 40s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow morning, clearing as the day goes on with highs in the upper 50s. There's a flood watch through this evening for Allen, Greenwood, Neosho, Wilson, and Woodson counties.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. All year we've been talking about foreign countries trying to swing the U.S. election. And in these final days of voting, American officials have called out Russia for circulating several fake videos targeting U.S. voters. NPR's Shannon Bond is following this. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Ari.
What do these fake videos show?
Yeah, so we've seen just in the past 2 weeks, at least three of them spread on social media that these officials and researchers have flagged as fakes. And look, these are pretty clumsy videos. There's some obvious signs they aren't real, but that didn't stop many people from sharing them. So most recently, there was a video posted to X on Thursday of a man who said he was a Haitian immigrant who was voting multiple times in Georgia. Just days before, there was a different video claiming to show someone ripping up ballots marked for former President Trump in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, another swing state. And there was also another fake video making baseless claims against Tim Walz, the Democratic vice presidential nominee. And look, Ari, these Georgia and Pennsylvania videos, they were quickly debunked by state and local officials. And then we've had federal intelligence officials and the FBI come out and say all three videos were likely made by Russia. They say it's part of what they describe as the Kremlin's efforts to sow division among Americans and undermine confidence, ultimately, in this election.
And how similar or different is this from what we saw Russia attempt in the 2016 and 2020 elections?
Yeah, experts say that Russia is much more active this year, right? So they're just doing more. And in some ways, these efforts are more sophisticated. So if you remember back to 2016, the Internet Research Agency, that infamous Russian troll farm, right? They made fake accounts on social media posing as Americans, right? And they pushed out these fake stories about Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. Now, researchers believe these fake videos that we've been talking about are actually being produced by a group that's a successor to the Internet Research Agency. They stage these fake videos, but then they're laundering them in many cases through influencers. And then we're seeing them get picked up and shared by actual Americans. So, you know, these are not being spread by fake accounts. I spoke with Darren Linvell, who leads a team at Clemson University, which first identified this operation.
They've put effort into building the network. They put effort into, you know, making these connections with real humans. But it is also true that people are now primed for, I mean, you can't separate these things. The Russians changed their tactics to conform to the changes in our reality.
And what Linville is talking about here is this idea, you know, many Americans have become much more receptive to these claims that, you know, something fishy is going on. There's something wrong with elections, which have come after so many years of Donald Trump's attacks on election integrity. And now we see Russia really capitalizing on that.
Is it only Russia, or have other countries also been trying to influence this election?
Right. Well, Russia is the most prolific, but intelligence officials have also called out Iran and China as really active threats trying to reach American voters. And what's common among all three of these countries, which have different aims, but what's common among their tactics this year is this focus on divisive issues, you know, that are trying to exacerbate existing fractures in American society. You know, they're targeting specific groups of people. They're seizing on narratives, for example, about immigration, like we saw in that video from Russia, about abortion, the war in Gaza, and now, as voting comes to an end, the integrity of American elections. And look, this is just not going to end when polls close tomorrow. As we expect, it takes time to determine a winner. Intelligence officials are warning that these adversaries will likely keep doing this through the post-election period.
That is NPR's Shannon Bond, who will keep following this throughout the post-election period. Shannon, thank you for your reporting.
Thanks, Ari.
In this heated election season, places of worship across the United States find themselves caught in the middle of intense partisan divides. As Zane Irwin of the Kansas News Service reports, one church in the Kansas City area has sparked a national effort to lower the temperature on the political conversation.
4 years ago, Pastor Adam Hamilton worried that his 24,000-member church in Kansas City was splitting at the political seams.
Our community has gotten, and our society has gotten, more and more polarized.
After decades of refereeing debates at the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection about abortion, LGBTQ inclusion, and racism, it all got to be too much.
There have been two periods of time where I felt most like quitting. I told my wife this once in one of those periods, and I said, you know, are you okay if I take another job? And one time she asked me this question, is God calling you to leave, or are you running away?
Despite the political tension, the graffiti attacks, and the angry emails, Hamilton stayed. But he knew Resurrection would have to get creative if they wanted to counteract the social media algorithms and politicians working to divide his community.
I might tell you a little bit about our campaign, this Campaign for Kindness. Is that all right?
Resurrection's Campaign for Kindness has all the trappings of the political programming you're probably sick of seeing. Billboards, yard signs, and even TV spots. But instead of candidates or policies, their campaign advertises ethics.
Choosing kindness isn't about avoiding our differences, but navigating them with respect and compassion.
This election cycle, more than 1,600 churches across the country have signed on to use sermon outlines and branding from the campaign, including some in pivotal swing states like Wisconsin.
We are completely buried with the advertising coming from every direction about anything you can think of.
Pastor Annalisa Hunter leads Suamico Methodist Church just outside of Green Bay. Political experts say this county could help decide the outcome of the presidential race. Folks in her community, like many Americans, are feeling the pressure.
What they have noticed in the last 10 years in their neighborhood is that people who are Republican and Democrat don't talk to each other anymore.
Suamico UMC is wrapping up a 6-week sermon series, courtesy of the Campaign for Kindness, on what the Bible says about discussing politics. To summarize, it doesn't always have to be apocalyptic.
We're trying to blanket Kansas City in love, compassion, understanding, and just calm down. You know, we're going to make it.
Back at the Church of the Resurrection in Leawood, Kansas, Doug Wyckoff is helping distribute signs for the campaign. Before he got involved, he says his hobbies were golfing, fishing, and getting angry at the news.
My wife would comment. She said, you're getting to be a grumpy old man. And I think I was.
That started to change when Hamilton challenged his church to do a certain number of kind acts every day, especially for people they disagree with. Wyckoff says it helped him turn his political rage into something more productive.
And I don't think I'm a grumpy old man anymore. So, yeah, I found out maybe that was my purpose or something.
As millions of Americans feel anxious about the presidential election, Hamilton hopes his campaign for kindness can make a difference, even if it's just one grumpy old man at a time. For NPR News, I'm Zane Irwin in Leawood.
The first polls close tomorrow at 6 p.m. Eastern, and you'll want to tune in right here for special coverage. After All Things Considered, we'll have results and analysis late into the night. Not just of the presidential race, we are also following who controls Congress, ballot measures, and more. Join us tomorrow night for coverage right here and on NPR.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Laura Lorson. Kansas generally isn't a battleground state nationally, but several key races are on the ballot here, including the makeup of the entire state legislature. Experts say first-time voters could play a decisive role. That includes the thousands of Kansans who become new citizens each year. Rose Conlon of Kansas News Service filed this story.
In a crowded auditorium in Wichita, more than 120 people from 33 countries are gathered to take the oath of citizenship.
Please repeat after me. I hereby declare on oath that I absolutely...
The ceremony was the last in Kansas before the state closed voter registration last month. As new citizens filter out, they're met with hugs, flowers, and tears from family and friends. Volunteers with the League of Women Voters Wichita are also here to help them register to vote.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Are you ready to register to vote?
Yes.
Okay, we have clipboards at both tables.
Okay.
Nancy Brown is the League's co-president. She approaches a man carrying two children.
You've got a handful. Why don't I just tuck this in your envelope?
Okay. I read over the application.
And you can do it online with that card.
Okay, cool. Thank you very much.
Hey, you're very well. Part of it is reading the situation.
Brian says nearly half of the people who became citizens earlier this day registered to vote.
It's just a really exciting time to be engaging potential voters. And when I'm helping somebody register, I always remind them, okay, you're registered now. Do your research and get out and vote.
There are around 79,000 immigrants in Kansas who are now citizens and eligible to vote, according to a Pew Research Center analysis, comprising 4% of the state's electorate. They're older than U.S.-born voters, and they're more likely to have a college degree. Jens Monwell Krogstad is a senior editor at Pew.
In close races, there are enough immigrant-eligible voters in Kansas where they could play a key role in deciding an outcome.
Every last vote will be important in determining the makeup of the Kansas legislature, where a few hundred votes sometimes separates winners and losers. A handful of races are expected to decide whether Republicans hold on to their legislative supermajority. Ifeanyi Obiajalu is an ICU nurse who moved to Kansas from Nigeria 6 years ago. He lives in Salina, but he's been in Wichita working at Ascension Via Christi St. Francis since the spring. Now that he's a citizen, he hopes it'll be easier for his wife to join him in Kansas. He's also excited to participate in the democratic process.
Trying to contribute and also being involved in politics. So becoming a citizen avails me that opportunity to, you know, run for an office, you know, get involved in what is going on in the country, perhaps in my local community and county.
An opportunity, he says, he didn't have in the same way in Nigeria.
Some of us didn't really come from a place where you have the liberty to do what is right. You know, so I feel very happy to be here.
Sandrine Lisk is a Wichita immigration attorney who's helped people become citizens for nearly 30 years. She says most of her clients have lived in the U.S. for a decade or longer, and they have complex reasons for pursuing citizenship. But she says politics is an increasing factor.
This year, particularly, most people have wanted to naturalize so that they can vote.
She says some of her clients are worried about what they see as rising anti-immigrant rhetoric in the U.S. Others are scared of experiencing voter intimidation at the polls, which Lisk says is rare, but occasionally happens.
I spoke to someone who is from a different part of the world and had a very strong accent and had to prove over and over and over again that he was a naturalized citizen entitled to vote.
Voter intimidation is illegal, and anyone who experiences it should tell poll workers. Obia Jalou says he's excited about voting this election, but he's most looking forward to settling down in Kansas for good.
Back home in Nigeria, I lived in a very busy and big city. So when I came at first, Kansas seemed a little bit laid back. But after living here for a while, I developed more love for Kansas. So since then, I'm stuck, and I like being stuck in Kansas.
For the Kansas News Service, I'm Rose Conlin in Wichita.
If you encounter voter intimidation, you can call the Justice Department's District Election Officer for Kansas at 785-295-2850. Again, that's 785-295-2850. The Kansas News Service reports on health, economics, education, and many other issues connected to public policy. To hear more stories like this one, visit the KPR website, kansaspublicradio.org.
If you've got an old car that won't make it through another Kansas winter, KPR's vehicle donation program can help. We turn your donated vehicle into the programs you enjoy every day. Donate your car online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Coming up on KPR, what the latest numbers say and what to look for as the election comes to a close. We will also have a quick overview of what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is saying about health care. He's been sort of embracing some fringe health care ideas for decades. We'll tell you more coming up.
Support for KPR comes from KU's Spencer Museum of Art, now showing the exhibition Native Fashion, celebrating wearable artworks created by indigenous people historically and today. Details at spencerart.ku.edu.
This is KPR. It's 10 minutes before 6.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. All right, it's time now for our science news roundup from Shortwave, NPR's science podcast. I'm joined by the show's dynamic duo, Regina Barber and Emily Kwong. Hey, ladies.
Hey, Elsa.
Hi, Elsa. So good to be here.
So good to be with you. All right, so you have brought us three science stories that caught your attention this week. What are they?
We have these two amazing students who developed new math for proving the Pythagorean theorem. How animals eating overripe fruit in the wild may have affected evolution. Mm. And the discovery of a fossil that sheds new light on the life cycle of frogs.
Frogs! All right, well, what I really want to do is relive eighth grade geometry class, so let us start with the students tackling the Pythagorean theorem. What is their story?
Okay, so in 2022, two high school students shocked the math world by solving the Pythagorean theorem using trigonometry. And for doing this, Kelsey Johnson and Nakia Jackson earned keys to the city of New Orleans.
Whoa.
And now they are published mathematicians. Kelsey and Nakia published their work, Five Proofs and a Method for Finding at Least Five More, in the journal American Mathematical Monthly. It's super prestigious, and seeing the paper online, Kelsey started jumping up and down.
It's really great to see it not just on my own laptop, because that's where it's been for a very long time.
Wait, how old are they now?
They're sophomores in college.
That's incredible. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, can we just back up a little bit, though? Because the Pythagorean theorem, in case anyone needs a refresher course, it's about the three sides of a triangle that has one right angle, right?
Yeah, so over 2,000 years ago, the Greek philosopher Pythagoras figured out the equation a squared plus b squared equals c squared. Right.
Yes.
To calculate the length of a right triangle.
I mean, I still chant it in my sleep. It was drilled deep into my soul 35 years
ago.
Was
that a math cheer? Amazing.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. That theorem has been proven again and again with geometry and algebra, but it was once thought impossible to do with trigonometry. Like, only two other mathematicians had done it before Kelsey and Nakia. And that's because trigonometry is, like, based on the Pythagorean theorem, mm-hmm. so it's tricky to use trigonometry to prove it.
Ah, I mean, this is kind of circular reasoning, right?
Right, but Kelsey and Nakaya proved it could be done. They actually developed 5 proofs in total.
Kelsey's little overachievers.
Yeah. Kelsey's particularly proud of the proof that involves this infinite series of little triangles, which looks like a waffle cone.
Ooh, yummy, yummy. Mm. So wait, what's next for these two math superstars?
They're in college. Kelsey is studying environmental engineering at Louisiana State University, while Nakaya is studying pharmacy at Xavier University. And Nakaya had some advice for today's high schoolers. Finish what you start.
I know there's moments where you're like, I don't want to do this for real. But in the long run, it might be something that could have mattered if you had just tried or kept with it.
And that's certainly true for her and Kelsey, who both wanted to thank their parents for all their support.
Aw, what good kids.
I know, good kids.
All right, so let's move on. We're going to talk about overripe fruit. Animals eat this. I mean, I do.
I mean, I do too. Elsa, have you heard of something called the drunken monkey hypothesis?
No, but this makes me want to hang out with some drunk monkeys.
Same. LOL. Okay. The drunken monkey hypothesis suggests that our human interest in alcohol may be due to the abundance of alcohol, especially ethanol, from all that rotting, naturally fermenting fruit in the wild.
No way.
Which animals have eaten throughout history.
Huh.
Yeah, but there was no consensus for this hypothesis among scientists who studied primates when the theory was proposed decades ago.
There was like 90% of primatologists who thought fermented fruit was very rare, and then there's 10%, a handful of primatologists who thought it was so common to be uninteresting. And that was kind of like the divide.
That's Matthew Kerrigan, who's an author of a review paper, which is an article that looks at a lot of studies that came out in the journal Trends in Ecology and Evolution.
Okay, so did they figure out how common it is for animals to eat fermented fruit?
So this review paper claims that many animals consume large amounts of fruit to survive, and they are bound to encounter fermented fruit with low levels of ethanol. So consuming this specific kind of alcohol is most likely very common. Also, if you eat a lot of these fruits, that alcohol is gonna make you tipsy. Yeah, and intoxication is dangerous out in the wild. Like, animals would be too vulnerable to predators or falling out of a tree. So Matthew says that our primate ancestors likely had to adapt to alcohol consumption and more or less become functional drinkers. They probably didn't have a choice.
And so it kind of flips the story in the head. Rather than being, you know, humans consuming alcohol to get drunk, to now perhaps it's the other way around, that animals are either intentionally or can't avoid consuming ethanol that they're going to be exposed to on a perhaps very routine basis.
Okay, so I have these monkeys to thank for how we evolved
yeah.
to be able to drink
yeah.
and break down alcohol because our ancestors apparently could not avoid it.
Yeah. Yeah. Matthew says we still don't know for sure if like animals actually prefer fermented fruit, like sometimes seek it out. There needs to be more studies on that. But scientists are seeing more and more evidence that this was an evolutionary advantage to have enzymes break down alcohol, which may have led to many human civilizations enjoying it.
So interesting. Okay. Well, we have to move on
yeah.
now to another story about the animal world. I hear a new fossil of a frog has been found.
You heard that right. though it is technically the fossil of a tadpole, the oldest known fossil of a tadpole. Tadpole, that's the larval stage of a frog's life, you know, when they're just little swimming polywogs with a tail.
Right, like, because frogs are like butterflies or salamanders in that they go through metamorphosis from their larval to their adult stage, yeah?
Yeah, we call this the biphasic life cycle.
Mm.
Back to this, like, really cool fossil. This tadpole fossil is 161 million years old from the middle to late Jurassic period, and it's incredibly intact, like, which is shocking because tadpoles are really delicate. They're made mostly of cartilage. And also, the tadpole stage only lasts a few months before the tadpole transforms into that adult frog. So it's been very hard for scientists to find tadpole fossils that are this well-preserved. Mariana Chulivert is the lead author of a new paper about this in the journal Nature. She said when she saw the fossil, she knew immediately what it was.
I said, okay, it's a tadpole. There is no doubt. But then when I saw it under the binocular microscope, I said, okay, this is the best tadpole ever. Because up to now, there wasn't any other fossil tadpole with the gill skeleton preserved.
The best tadpole ever with a preserved gill skeleton.
Yeah.
Okay. Does this amazingly preserved specimen teach us anything about you know, frogs or how they evolve.
Yes, they think so. I mean, one of the interesting things about this specimen is its size. It's almost 2 times as big as the tadpoles we see today.
Wow.
And it is the oldest tadpole ever found by 20 million years.
Yeah, this discovery proves that the tadpole phase goes way further back in evolutionary time than we knew. So like any kid who stared into a puddle knows how awesome tadpoles are. It turns out they're even more awesome than we thought if you ask evolution.
Wow, I have an even more robust love for tadpoles now.
Definitely. We share the earth with so many other species but us, so I'm comforted by this.
That is Emily Kwong and Regina Barber from NPR's science podcast, Shortwave, which you can subscribe to for new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and the science behind the headlines. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you, Elsa.
Thank you, Elsa.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations meet their food needs, from online ordering to simplified expense reporting, with a nationwide network of restaurants all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. From Insperity, providing HR services and technology, from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
Brat summer might be over, but at Morning Edition from NPR News, we're always here to help you understand the vibe of the season. Oh, and the news, too. Join us every weekday.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7. KANB and KANB HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3. KANQ Chanute 90.3. K210CR Atchison 89.9. K258BT Manhattan 99.5. And at kansaspublicradio.org. It's 6 o'clock.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a science denialist. He makes up his own scientific truths and ignores the actual truths.
Public health experts are alarmed at former President Trump's reliance on RFK Jr. as a health policy advisor.
For Monday, November 4th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, we'll get the results from NPR's final election poll.
And we're about to learn the impact of social media companies taking a more hands-off approach to election misinformation.
In some sense, they're greasing the skids for violence or greasing the skids for conspiracy theories.
Later, we'll hear reflections from the late Quincy Jones in his own words.
My teacher said, well, you're going to learn everything everybody ever did with the 12 notes, from Stravinsky to Alvin Berg to Duke Ellington, everybody.
And an actual scientific study of how long it would take a monkey with a typewriter to bang out Hamlet.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Democratic presidential ticket is counting on support from labor unions on Election Day, especially in union strongholds like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Nevada. But as NPR's Don Gowney reports from Detroit, the labor vote is not a monolith.
The leadership of the United Auto Workers Union has launched an aggressive get-out-the-vote operation on behalf of Kamala Harris. UAW President Sean Fain is one of Donald Trump's harshest critics.
Which side are you on? And we know which side Kamala Harris is on, and we sure as hell know which side Donald Trump's on, and it's not ours.
Harris has marched on picket lines. Trump, meanwhile, said in an online chat with Elon Musk that striking workers should be fired. Still, Trump's campaign resonates with middle and working class men. Go to any Trump rally and you'll find auto workers or Teamsters in the crowd. Don Gagne, NPR News, Detroit.
In what amounts to an election eve sprint, the respective presidential candidates are on a last-minute blitz for votes in key states. Republican Donald Trump is making four stops in three states, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. Trump will wind up the night in Grand Rapids. Democratic presidential contender Kamala Harris is spending all day in Pennsylvania and will end her night in Philadelphia. Polls, at least in Pennsylvania, with its 19 electoral votes, show the candidates in a statistical dead heat. Both candidates have events in Pittsburgh today, with the Harris campaign also holding a streaming Get Out the Vote event involving all seven battleground states. An unannounced appearance on Saturday Night Live this weekend by Vice President Harris led to an outcry by allies of former President Trump. He was not getting fair treatment. NPR's David Folkenflik explains. NBC and Trump arranged for him to address sports fans on the network Sunday.
Harris appeared with Maya Rudolph, her comedic doppelganger, in a sketch that went viral on social media. Brendan Carr, a Republican commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission, argued that was unfair to Trump, especially just days before Election Day. Regulations require broadcast networks and stations to give equal time to opposing candidates when someone running for office appears on a non-news show, assuming that candidate asks for it. Trump's campaign tells NPR that NBC and its parent company Comcast reached out to fulfill its equal time obligations. He cut a 60-second video on Sunday after a rally in Pennsylvania. It ran during a NASCAR broadcast and a post-NFL show. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
The Federal Reserve Board's rate-setting open market committee meets this week in Washington. It's widely anticipated when the Fed meeting concludes Thursday. Policymakers will announce another interest rate cut, the expected quarter of a point cut, the second this year since the Fed began easing rates. Stocks lost ground on Wall Street today. The Dow fell 257 points. The Nasdaq was down 59 points. This is NPR. Scientists have long known that being exposed to light at night can be detrimental to our health. NPR's Will Stone reports on new research that shows how much light we get and when can have a major consequence.
Nearly 90,000 people in the UK wore a light-sensing device for a week. Then researchers based in Australia analyzed their risk of dying over the next 8 years. They found bright nights were associated with an increased risk of mortality. The top 10% who had the brightest evenings had a 34% increased risk of dying compared to those with darker evenings. On the other hand, people with the brightest days had a substantially lower risk. Daniel Windred, the study's lead author, says the best thing to do is get outside.
There's like a massive jump in the intensity between an indoor and an outdoor light environment.
In fact, research shows that brighter light during the day can make you less sensitive to disruptions in your circadian rhythms at night. Will Stone, NPR News.
Musical heavyweights, including Paul McCartney, Harry Connick Jr., and Ice-T, among those paying tribute to producer Quincy Jones, who died over the weekend at his home in Los Angeles. Jones, in a broad career, produced Michael Jackson's record-setting Thriller, as well as prize-winning film and TV scores with Frank Sinatra and Ray Charles. Born in Chicago in 1933, he was a musical director in Dizzy Gillespie's band, went on to produce records over a decades-long career. Quincy Jones was 91 years old. Crude oil futures prices moved higher today after OPEC agreed to delay a December output hike. Oil up $1.98 a barrel to end the session at $71.47 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Insperity, providing HR services and technology. From payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters.